Production. Recorded live.
Greetings, silent sheep of the house of Israel. You chose the seed of Israel's race. Ye who did hear Christ call and who answered. Anyway, tonight is Understanding Dual Seed Line Christian Identity of what? The 9th of July, 2013. And I'm going to probably do a little bit longer than 2 hours because I went and doctored Roxy. And pretty well what Logan has done in his companion series covering the book of Jasher. And, pretty well he covered Jasher 88. And I read a little bit of the book of Joshua, but toward the end of the book of Jasher, they tend to move on rather quickly. And I was talking to Elder Gary. We have Elder Gary from Michigan, the thumb of Michigan around. And for those of you who know it, it's sort of hilarious because people from Michigan, they talk about how Michigan is shaped, except for the Upper Peninsula, of course, like a thumb, like a mitt. And I was reading this guy. He was from Michigan here. He moved to Florida. He sort of said the Florida shape sort of like a penis, but he didn't really want to talk about that. But he said that he was, Michigan is sort of shaped like a, hand here, sort of like a mitten here. He said that the middle finger was Jackson, which geographically wasn't altogether correct because Jackson was at the, south central portion of it, around the wrist here. But he says the middle finger because the people from Jackson are supposedly assholes. But anyway, I thought that was hilarious here. And we have Logan Hunter, and he's from around Michigan. Not Michigan, I'm sorry, Nashville, Tennessee. And pretty well, I started the book of Jasher. Let me go ahead and put it back here with Jasher chapter 88. And tonight's show, the agenda is post number 8920 of the whitenationalist.org/forum. It's today's latest post. So let's see. What am I reading from right now? Understand Dual Seed Line Christian Identity. Okay, tonight's an open panel discussion about Dual Seed Line Christian Identity with panelists Elder Gary from Michigan, Logan Hunter, and myself. Thus, this reinstituted show will be used to teach the basics of Dual Seed Line Christian Identity. Now, sometimes me and Logan do not all together agree, but because we are Christian brethren, we can agree to disagree in some cases. But really, I would say that we agree pretty well 90 or 95% of the time. And there hasn't been any
problems. We haven't really argued too much. I mean, like, if I don't, if I have a different point of view, I'll voice it. But, it's not like, it's just that. I'll voice it and I'll tell you what I believe and based on Scripture. And if I can't prove something, then, I'll say it's my opinion or whatever. And just leave it at that or whatever.
And we're three men who have come into Christian identity through different, through different means. I came into it from the Worldwide Church of God from the ages of 10 to the ages of not quite 21. And when pretty well, I was in rebellion against it between, the ages of 21 to about 33, 34, 35 years of it, years old. And then I went back to it. Yeah.
Always on it.
And I am, 55 and a half. Gary is 78. Logan Hunter, I believe, is 42 or 43. So we're men of different generations or half generations again. So we're men of different generations. We have come to it from different things. But what I found out among the real Israelites is that the fact that we're brethren, while we will have some minor doctrinal or maybe sometimes not so minor doctrinal disagreements, we don't scream about how people are blasphemers or heretics or anything like that here. We we do have a civilized panel discussion. This is not a, this is not, you know, sort of like Eli James and Skillet Licking Tard, Greg Howard, or, you know, Finkelschini and his little mamzer mentor, Brian Rio.
Well, thank you.
In any case, Logan Hunter, and we covered the Book of Jasher, and last week, last Friday, we finished it. Tonight, we're going to cover the Book of Joshua and the beginning of Judges, and it was a time period of slightly over a quarter century. Now, it said that Joshua got control. Joshua became the head when Moses died. He died on the east bank of the Jordan. And then they, you know, then they circumcised, you know, those who hadn't been circumcised, you know, the men, of course, who had not been circumcised throughout the wanderings and, you know, who may have been a young babies when they were in Israel, when they were in Egypt, who were not circumcised. So what they did, they circumcised each other in, you know, in chapter 5 of Joshua. And previously, in the first 5 books of Moses, the Israelites couldn't attack their cousins, the Edomites, even though the Edomites were intermarried with the Canaanites, particularly the Hivites / Hittites, and they couldn't fight with the Moabites, and they couldn't fight with the Ammonites. But these Canaanite kings had instead, you know, conveniently attacked Israel and had been destroyed, and Moses had essentially conquered literally these Amorite giants, Og and Sihon. And in other books of the Bible, one giant of the Apocrypha or pseudo-Apocrypha, one of them, supposedly Og, had crawled aboard the ark and been fed by Noah in return for not causing trouble. And both giants were, well, roughly about 12 foot tall. They were big even for giants. They were roughly twice the size of a normal man and more than likely about 4 or 5 times his weight. They were, you know, they had a bedstead that was 13 foot tall or 15 foot tall, which meant that they were at least 12 foot tall. Long-lived, and they were over these Amorites. And these Amorites were, well, I thought it was the eighth, but actually it was the fourth son of Canaan. But these Amorites were, I've gone ahead and clicked, you know, in the thing here. The Sidonians were the Phoenicians. The Hittites were the children of Heth. The Jebusites were these people who lived in the mountains and who had founded this city called Jebus, which occasionally gone over, and sometimes it was called Salem. Later on, it was called Jerusalem. But, you know, generally we're talking probably a period of time of around, what, 1500 or so, maybe 1550. You know, a good 100 years before the Book of Joshua is claimed, because the date of 1451 essentially would have been during the reign of Thutmose III, which does not make very much sense if you knew who Thutmose III was, the Napoleon of Egypt, and he pretty well rampaged all through Canaan. So I believe that the Israelites had essentially rebelled or had been kept in subjection in the land of Goshen, which was in the eastern delta underneath the thumb of these Hyksos kings. And that essentially that would stand to reason, Josephus believed that was the case, because the native Egyptians, they called the Hyksos foreign rulers, they would not have wanted to say is that they beat the Hyksos because, you know, some of their slaves rebelled against them. The Egyptians wanted to say it was due to our own work that we drove these foreign rulers out. After the second intermediate period between the Middle Kingdom and the New Kingdom. And the very tail end of the 17th, you know, you had three dynasties of Hyksos and three dynasties of, you know, native Theban rulers. You know, the first Theban ruler had lost control of Upper Egypt around the Delta. So, you know, pretty well Memphis was pretty well the middle, the midpoint between the Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. Anyway, you hear that the Israelites had made these cities, which were also in the upper delta around Goshen. They didn't make it around Thebes. They didn't make it in upper Egypt. They made it in the delta. In any case, that seems to me the most logical thing. Now, when you are looking at Wikipedia, you will hear these learned men claim that, you know, the Exodus didn't really actually historically happen, that the Israelites were Canaanites or something like that, and they don't believe the Bible, which is fine by me. I don't believe their horseshit either. So, you know, moving on, you have the Bible, and the Bible confirms archaeology. Now, sometimes archaeology does not confirm the Bible because it doesn't have anything to do with what happened in the Bible. The Bible only covers really two seed lines, the good seed line of, you know, of the Adamic people, and not just all the Adamic people. Only one Adamic son, a.k.a. Seth, through to Noah, through to Shem, through to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Israel. So, yes, we are a numerous people. We were a numerous people, and we interbred, I believe, with other Adamites. But, you know, it doesn't, you know, there's only two people that are of really any concern here. One, you know, one is the house of, you know, the sons of true men, the Israelites. And the other are the spawn of Satan, the Jews.
Yeah.
Now,
the descendants of Cain, we're really not concerned with the pure black and the pure Asiatic race as far
I think the niggers are somewhat mentioned as beasts of the field or animals.
I know some people say the niggers are the beasts of the field, and they say that the Chinese are the six-day man or six-day creation. Whatever you want to teach or believe, but they're not the children of light. They're not the children of darkness. We're not concerned in the warfare of good and evil. They can be used as pawns by Satan's kids to fight us, but they are not the main instigators and culprits. They are not the tares. They are not the goats. They are not the tares. The tares are the children of Cain. Is that right?
Well, it's tares on the children of Cain. There's only two seed lines that the Bible is interested in. Now, when they talk about beasts of the field, you can say, well, that must have been niggers. It could have been white people who were descendants from the Cro-Magnons. You know, they could have been other Adamites to whom Yahweh did not give a covenant to or a spirit to. Essentially, these are people who are outside the concern. You know, the Bible only concerns itself with two seed lines. So generally, if someone says, well, the Bible doesn't say anything about what happened in the Mayan civilizations, the answer is no, it does not. The Bible does not really even discuss what happened in Britain. You know, during the Book of Jasher, you had a number of digressions about what was going on in the land of Italy, you know, in the peninsula of Italy, when they were fighting against these North Africans. And in many cases, they were saying that, you know, you had some fight between these Esauites or Edomites, and you had fights between the land of Chittim, which was Italy. And then later on, toward the end, they were talking about Javan, which was, well, essentially the Japhethic Greeks. And you have some digressions in the Book of Jasher, and it is important to Jasher, and it's sort of a filler, but it's not the main story. You know, it's not the main reason we read the Book of Jasher. It was something that was interesting, but and they were talking about how, you know, Italy had conquered all the way to Britannia. And another land, which I imagine was probably, you know, Greece. Now, these Canaanites, getting on with these Canaanites, we're covering the history of the early Israelite people from around 1500 BC, more or less. And we're covering essentially a period which would have been anywhere around to 475, to where here are these Egyptians. They are busily fighting the Hyksos. They do not have time to concern themselves with what these Hyksos slaves are doing, wandering around and beating the crap out of the Canaanites, because, well, essentially they have these Hyksos they have to deal with. So, you know, in short, the power of the Egyptians during the days of Joshua would have been minimal. This was just simply small, fortified, in some cases, or unfortified Canaanite towns and villages against a people of footmen who had about, you know, who numbered about 600 or so thousand. Essentially, they were not especially archers. There were some slingers, but mostly it was a tribe of spearmen. If you read, most of the footmen did not have swords. They merely had a bronze, maybe iron in some cases, but mainly bronze. They had mainly a bronze spearhead and a shaft of wood, sort of like a shepherd's rod. You go ahead and put that spearhead on to that shepherd's rod in some cases, and do so. And some places they said put a paddle on the end of your spear to dig you a place to take a crap here when you're out on the march here. So anyway, these Canaanites were a cursed breed of Jews, so to speak here. They were descended from Canaan. Canaan was the son of Ham, but he was also the son of a mother who, as we look at it, was named Naamah, and it was not the Naamah who was married to Noah. It was the Naamah who was Tubal-Cain's sister, the product of the daughters of Seth, you know, well, through Seth, but also of this Canaanite called Lamech, who accidentally killed his forebearer, Cain, in Genesis chapter 4. So we had learned this earlier in the Book of Jasher. Now, these Canaanites were cursed because they were of the evil seed line, and they consisted of the following: the Sidonians, a.k.a. the Phoenicians, the Hittites, comma, children of Heth. Now, if you click on the Hittite thing, it admits that these Hittites lived in the land of Canaan, but they also lived in central Anatolia, or Turkey. You have the Jebusites, who lived around what became Jerusalem. The Amorites were, in many ways, not because they were so warlike, but they were, they were dangerous because they had a tendency to be blonde, blue-eyed, with smaller noses. They were sort of like the Leslie Stahl Jews. They were able to fool Phineas and Joshua into thinking that they were white, white from far away, and therefore suitable for making a treaty of peace with. And you have these other tribes, and I went ahead and underlined the Sinites because these were other tribes who were wandering around, like the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites. I imagine the Sinites probably lived were Canaanites who were outcroppings on the northern peninsula of the Sinai, around the wilderness of Sin. The Arvadites, the Zemarites, the Hamathites. So you had these minor Canaanite tribes who, in some cases, lived as far away as Syria. They lived around in that area. So when the Israelites are coming out, you have pretty well you don't have any major empires contending. You have the Egyptians who have to contend with the Hyksos. You have the old Assyrians, why they're pretty well quiescent. You have the Babylonians, you have the Mesopotamian people, and essentially they're pretty quiescent. They're not really doing much of anything. Now, there's some belief in dual seed line that Shem killed Nimrod. The Worldwide Church of God historian Herman Hay believed that. But we looked at the book of Jasher and it said that Esau killed Nimrod. Now, you know, me and Pastor John Britton believe that was Neo-Nimrod, a.k.a. Tammuz. But in any case, we've gone ahead and covered. So this is a period of time when they are, you know, when Moses has conquered the eastern bank of the Jordan all the way up, you know, up to about where it's called the Golan Heights, which is the headwaters of the Jordan, you know, the headwaters of the Jordan, the source of the Jordan. And it was known for its oak trees, but especially it was known for its cattle grazing. And the tribe of, I think, what, Reuben and Gad had said, well, hey, we'll leave more for the rest of the Israelites on the west bank of the Jordan. We like this just fine. And so Moses said, well, you do understand that, yes, you're going to put your old men and your women up. You know, you're going to go ahead and, you know, leave your herds. You're going to leave a rear guard. You're going to go ahead and rebuild these cities that we've destroyed, of the Canaanites, and, you know, these people we put to the sword. You're going to go ahead and repile the stones. But essentially what you're going to do is you are going to bring your fighting men, you know, probably, what, three-quarters of your fighting men as essentially scouts, because they're not going to be held up by women and children. You have to, you know, look, you know, Reuben and Gad, you have to do your share of the fighting. And essentially, the Reubenites and Gadites said, we'll do that. And half the tribe of Manasseh said, hey, you know, half of us want to stay here. We're really more like cattle herders than we are farmers or vineyard tenders or whatever. Yeah, we want to do it too. And pretty much that is the deal they did. Now, we read in Joshua chapter 1 that Joshua, you know, Moses died on the very last chapter of Deuteronomy. And so we're covering Joshua chapter 88. And in chapter 1, the book of Joshua, Joshua succeeds Moses. And we have that here. Then we have in chapter 2, Rahab and the two spies, that, you know, that these two spies go to Jericho. This is right across from the Jordan. And pretty well, here are all these Canaanites, and they are scared. They are scared that here comes the Israelites, 600,000 men strong. No city can stand up to a concentrated assault. And so she had gone and agreed to hide these two spies in return for her household, her inn, her chattels, her cattle, or whatever. They were to stay within her inn, and it was to be marked by a red cord. Chapter 3, Joshua marches to the Jordan. In that chapter, Joshua has the Ark of the Covenant sitting in the middle of the Jordan, and the Jordan flows down, but it piles up right up against them, And the entire congregation of Israel, 2 million or so strong, marches across on dry land. They take 12 stones, undressed, to represent the 12 tribes. Then, chapter 4 of Joshua, they pass over Joshua. I'm going through this real quick because I already read this earlier. Chapter 5, the Passover is kept at Gilgal, and the manna ceases. And at this time, they circumcise still on the west bank. So they cross the Jordan, and they're just before Jericho. They've crossed the Jordan, and they keep the Passover at Gilgal. And what they do is they circumcise those males who have not already been circumcised, because they were what? Oh, infants when they left Egypt, or you know, even up to maybe 19 or 20 years old when they left Egypt. They would have been closer to 60. But all those who were not circumcised were circumcised, you know, and the Passover is kept, and the manna ceases, you know, in Joshua chapter 5. And at this time, here comes the host of the Lord, and he allows Joshua to worship him. So it was likely Yahweh in the flesh, or Christ, who had essentially reaffirmed the mantle for Joshua. Okay, did I read about the fall of Jericho? I think I did, didn't I? In case, you know, Joshua chapter 6 is about the fall of Jericho. The entire armed men would circle one time for every day. And on the seventh day they marched around seven times, then they blew their horn and the walls fell down except for Rahab's inn, which was on a section of the wall. Okay? So I didn't cover Joshua chapter 7, and that's where I'm going to go ahead and start. All right? Let me go ahead and look at the chat room and see how it is going. I haven't been looking for a while. Okay, here. Well, looks like Pearson was in here. We have about the same. We have the same people, and pretty well. There's not too much chat because we're pretty well discussing that. Anyway, Gary, Logan, do you have any comment?
No.
Okay. No. Go ahead.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and start. I'm going to start with Joshua chapter 7, because I believe that I had read previously to Joshua chapter 6. But at the very beginning here, at the very middle of Joshua chapter 6, it says, "Hey, look, folks, none of you are to take any loot. Now, you are to go ahead and kill everything that breathes except for whatever was locked up in Rahab's inn. You were to kill everything that breathed. You know, all those that are in, only Rahab the harlot or innkeeper shall live. She had all those with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent." Verse 18, "And you, and if in any wise, keep yourself from the accursed thing, lest you make yourself a curse when you take of the accursed thing and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it." Well, I think what this accursed thing probably was idols. Were idols from these Baal gods that these Canaanites worshiped, pictures of demon entities. Probably the vestments for these demon entities. Because you hear about the accursed thing, and the reason I'm bringing that up is it's going to have some relevance in Joshua chapter 7. "But all the silver and gold and the vessels of brass and iron, they're consecrated unto the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord." So essentially, these metals were to pass through fire, and they were not to be, this loot was not to be given. It was not to be divided out. It was to go to the treasury of the Lord. That's what it says. It's to the treasury of Yahweh. It is to, it was for the usage of the Levites and their tabernacle and the rest of their accoutrements. It was, you know, nothing. Nothing was to be taken by the Israelites. So essentially, it was a strong anti-looting, you know, message that was given. You know, this is not yours. I mean, you know, in the case of Jericho, the Israelites, all they had to do was march around Jericho. They didn't have to expend a single life in taking it. There was no danger in what they had to do. Yahweh had given the lives and the property of the people of Jericho all together to the Israelites. And later on, Joshua cursed Jericho. Cursed be the man before the Lord that rise up and rebuilds the city. He shall lay the foundation there in his firstborn, and his youngest son shall he set the gates of it. So anyone who tries to rebuild this city, it's going to go ahead and go through his entire children. He's going, you know, his oldest son's going to die on the foundations. His youngest son's going to die when the gates, you know, the last portion of it are set up. Okay, Joshua chapter 7. Achan's grave trespass. Verse 1 of Joshua chapter 7. But the children of Israel committed trespass in the accursed thing. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed thing, and the anger of Yahweh was kindled against the children of Israel. Verse 2, and Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is beside Bethaven on the east side of Bethel, and spoke unto them, saying, go up and view the country. And the men went up and viewed Ai. So he sent a little scouting party, sort of like I'm looking on PBS to Lewis and Clark. He sent probably maybe 50, 100 men to spy out what's next. They viewed Ai. Verse 3, and they returned to Joshua and said to him, let not all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and spy Ai, and make not all the people to labor thither, for they are but a few. So this was a small, fortified town. Verse 4, so they went up thither of the people, about 3,000 men, and they fled before the men of Ai. Verse 5, the men of Ai smote of them about 36 men, for they chased them from before the gate, even unto Shebarim, and smote them in going down. Wherefore the hearts of the people melted and became as water. So there is a reverse. They only sent 3,000 men out, around 3,000 men. 36 of them, you know, they're sent fleeing by the men of Ai who stormed out their gate and killed 36 men. Because, we're going to find out, because some greedy bastard went ahead and took stuff that, you know, he was told not to take. He was of the tribe of Judah. Verse 6, and Joshua rent his clothes and fell to the earth upon his face before the ark of the Lord until the eventime he and the elders of Israel put dust upon their heads. So this is a reverse. And Joshua, along with the elders, what they are is that they are sitting right in front of the ark with ashes, with dirt on their face. Essentially, they're humbling themselves before Yahweh. What's wrong? Verse 7, Joshua said, alas, O Yahweh, wherefore have you all brought this people over Jordan to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites? So these were Amorite people to destroy us. Would to Yahweh we had been content and dwelt on the other side of the Jordan. I mean, heck, you know, I mean, we maybe shouldn't come over. We should just simply settle for what we had. Verse 8, O Yahweh, what shall I say when Israel turns their back before their enemies? Verse 9, for the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land shall hear of it and shall environ us round and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do unto your great name? Verse 10. I mean, know, pretty well, Joshua's pointing a, you know, domino theory. I mean, if you're going to let these people beat us here, I mean, we're just going to go. If a bunch of little mangy Amorites can whip us and kill 36 of us, and we run, I mean, the rest of the Canaanites are going to hear that, and well, there's not going to be any peace with them. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Is a I think a legitimate, you know, worry. Verse 10, and Yahweh said unto Joshua, get you up, wherefore lie, you know, you thus upon your face? You know, get up, why are you laying down? Verse 11, Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant, which I command them, for they have even taken of the accursed thing, and have also stolen and dissembled also, and they have put even among their own stuff. So essentially what they've done is that they've stolen, they've lied, they've gone ahead and, you know, mixed it up with their own stuff. This is not acceptable. But Yahweh said, not acceptable at all. Verse 12. Therefore the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies, but turned their backs before their enemies, because they were accursed. Neither will I be with you anymore, except you destroy the accursed from among you. Well, somebody took the accursed thing. You have to destroy this accursed person. Verse 13, up, sanctify the people, and say, sanctify yourselves against tomorrow, for thus saith the Lord God of Israel, there is an accursed thing in the midst of you, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you take away the accursed thing from among you. Verse 14, in the morning, therefore, you shall be brought according to your tribes, and it shall be the tribe which the Lord taketh, shall come according to the families thereof, and the family which the Lord shall take shall come by household, and the household by which the Lord shall take shall come man by man. So, what he's going to do is that I imagine all 13 tribes, but maybe only 12, because the Levites more than likely didn't have a chance to take this cursed thing, didn't have a chance to loot. You know, they wouldn't have bothered to loot because, remember, everything was going to go to them anyway. So they're going to take all the tribes, and they're going to go ahead and cast by lot. I think they called it the Urim and Thummim, but that may be Mormon stuff here. Verse 15, it shall be that he that is taken with the accursed thing shall be burnt with fire, he and all that he has, because he has transgressed the covenant of Yahweh, and because he has wrought folly in Israel. Verse 16. So Joshua rose up early in the morning and brought Israel by their tribes, and the tribe of Judah was taken. Verse 17. And he brought the family of Judah, and he took the family of the Zerahites, you know, not the Pharezites, certainly not the Shelites, and he brought the family of the Zerahites man by man, and Zabdi was taken. Verse 18, he brought his household man by man, and Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, was taken. Now, Zabdi, more than likely, was dead. Probably Carmi was dead, too. Probably Achan was what? Somewhere between the age of 20 and 60. Verse 19. And Joshua said to Achan, my son, give, I pray you, glory to Yahweh, God of Israel, and make confession unto him, and tell me now what you have done. Hide it not from me. Because, you know, Joshua says, hey, you're caught. You've done it. Lot said you did it. So tell me what you've done. Verse 20, and Achan answered Joshua and said, indeed, I have sinned against Yahweh, God of Israel, and thus have I done. This is what I've done. Verse 21 of Joshua 7. When I saw among the spoils a goodly Babylonish garment, he wanted a Babylonianish garment. This may have been some vestments to a Baal demon. But he's seen it. He liked it. It was beautiful. But it was to be burned. It was not to even be taken. And 200 shekels of silver. The silver was supposed to be turned over. And a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight. So pretty well you had about, 200 ounces of silver, 50 ounces of gold. And I coveted them and took them. And behold, they are hid in the earth in the midst of my tent, and the silver under it. Verse 22, so Joshua sent messengers, and they ran into the tent. Behold, it was hid in his tent, and the silver under it. Verse 23, and they took them out of the midst of the tent, and brought them unto Joshua, and unto all the children of Israel, and laid them out before Yahweh. Verse 24, and Joshua and all Israel with them took Achan, the son of Zerah, and the silver, and the garment, and the wedge of gold, and his sons, and his daughters, and his oxen, and his asses, and his sheep, and his tent, and all they had, and they brought them unto the valley of Achor. So essentially, it wasn't just Achan who died. His sons, his daughters, his animals, his asses, his oxen, his asses, his sheep. He had plenty. He was just greedy and stupid. Verse 25, and Joshua said, why have you troubled us? Yahweh shall trouble you this day. And all Israel stoned him with stones and burnt them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. So they threw rocks and killed Achan, killed his wife, killed his sons, killed his daughters, probably killed his grandchildren if they had any, killed his animals. And then they set the entire mess of bleeding flesh and of silver and of gold and of the costly Babylonian garment, which was the entire purpose of it, and set them on fire. Verse 26, they raised over him a great heap of stones unto this day. So the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Wherefore, the name of that place was called the Valley of Achor unto this day. And it says Achor, the valley of, is called trouble. It's called the Valley of Trouble unto this day. Well, I imagine that somebody probably went up and dug up the gold and dug up the silver. But later on, but not that day and not the day after. Okay, any comments, Logan? Any comments, Gary?
No.
Pretty well what is told here. Later on, the Bible says that those who are in charge of Israel who do evil, their families are responsible for their evil that they do as a regime criminal. But Achan was just simply just a thieving wigger. He was just simply someone greedy who could not mind. And because he could not mind, 36 men died. 36 fighting men died. And you know that every one of them had possibly a wife, children, fathers and mothers. What Achan did was serious. And here he was, just an ordinary thieving wigger. And what was required of him for his sin, for his deliberate sin, because he knew it was wrong. He hid the Babylonian garment. He hid the gold. He hid the silver, didn't he? He knew what he was doing was wrong. And probably when he was seeing the lots be cast here, and they went to the tribe of Judah, and they went to the tribe of Zabdi, and then to the tribe of his great-grandfather, then his grandfather, then his father, then him, he knew that essentially he had been found out. So all he could do was just get it over with. But let's understand something. You do evil. and someone else, some other Israelite family is hurt because of the evil that you do, the penalty might be not only your own destruction, but the destruction of your entire family. Achan was not, from my gathering, he was not a prince of Israel or of Judah. He was just simply some thieving wigger who was told not to do something, yet he decided to do it, and 36 other men got killed because of it. Okay? There's a lesson there, and that's why I've gone ahead and bought that. Folks, about every... When you're writing a story, oh yeah, I'm taking creative writing. They said if you're writing a novel or something like that, don't put extraneous crap in that. If essentially there is a gun, and you know, if there's a gun in chapter two, that gun had better be used. That gun had better be put out and used to have something to do by the end of the book, by the end of the novel. You're not covering everything that somebody did. You're covering only the high points of something. So essentially, when you go ahead and you bring up something, you know, it may not seem important. Surely if it's a mystery, the whole point of it is that there ought to be a logical means to where you can decipher the mystery for yourself. It's sort of like a puzzle book. Well, generally, throughout the Bible, I don't see anything superfluous in the Bible. This story of Achan was there for a reason. Not only because it happened, but you're supposed to understand that if you are a sinful wigger and you get other wiggers killed, you're responsible and your entire family is responsible for your sins. That's why, you know, I mean, I sort of had forgotten about this, but I did see it in Joshua chapter 7. I did want to cover it. Okay? Joshua chapter 8, AI, taken by strategy. Verse 1, and Yahweh said to Joshua, fear not, neither be you dismayed. Take all the people of war with you. So, pretty well. Here is 600-some-thousand armed men. Not 3,000, 600,000. Basically 200 times as many people as there were before. And arise, go up to Ai. See, I have given into your hand the king of Ai and his people and his city and his land. Verse 2, and you shall do to Ai and her king, as you did unto Jericho and her king. Only the spoil thereof and the cattle thereof shall you take for a prey unto yourself. Lay you an ambush for the city behind it. So I guess the cattle, you know, these were Amorites. They'd already talked about these Amoritish kings. They were also on the west bank of the Jordan. Verse 3. So Joshua arose and all the people of war to go up against Ai. And Joshua chose out 30,000 mighty men of valor and sent them away by night. So essentially what he did, 600,000 men, he chose 30,000 of them. What is that? Well, that's what? 1 in 20. That's pretty well the leadership ability. He went ahead and took his natural officer corps. He took an elite force of 30,000. Moving on, verse 4, and he commanded them, saying, behold, you shall lie in wait against the city, even behind the city. Go not very far from the city, but be you all ready. Verse 5, and I and all the people who are with me will approach in the city, and it shall come to pass when they come out against us as at the first, that we will flee before them. Verse 6, for they will come out after us, for we have drawn them out of the city, for they will say, they flee before us as at the first, therefore we will flee before them. Verse 7, then you shall rise up from the ambush and seize upon the city, for Yahweh your God will deliver it into your hand. actually took 1/20th of his fighting men, of the 600,000, 30,000 he took, had them hide behind the rocks behind the city. Here he is. He's going to go ahead and pretend to flee like he had before, and guess what? You're going to, well, first of all, we're going to catch him between two jaws of the trap. Verse 7, then shall you rise from the ambush and seize upon the city, for Yahweh your God will deliver it into your hand. Verse 8, it shall be that when you have taken the city, you shall set the city on fire according to all the commandment of Yahweh shall you do. See, I've commanded you. Verse 9, Joshua chapter 8. Joshua therefore sent them forth, and they went to lie in ambush in a boat between Bethel and Ai on the west side of Ai. But Joshua lodged that night among the people. Verse 10, and Joshua rose up early in the morning and numbered. It says underneath there, he mustered the people, went up, he and the elders of Israel, before the people to Ai. Verse 11, and all the people, even the people of war that were with him, went up and drew nigh and came before the city and pitched on the north side of Ai. Now there was a valley between them and Ai. Verse 12, he took about 5,000 men and set them to lie in ambush between Bethel and Ai on the west side of the city. So there's another city which is close called Bethel. Now remember when Joseph had left, he was running for his life, and it was around Bethel several hundred years before that he had dreamt. He had gone ahead and dreamt and seen angels going up and going down, and he had taken his pillow stone and set that as a rock. And tradition says that the rock of coronation is Jacob, Israel's pillow stone. Verse 13, and when they had set the people, even all the hosts that were on the north of the city and their liars and waited on the west of the city, Joshua went that night into the midst of the valley. Verse 14, it came to pass when the king of Ai saw it that they hastened and rose up earlier. The men of the city went out against Israel to battle, he and all his people at the time appointed before the plain. But he wist not, he knew not that there were liars and ambush against him behind the city. Verse 15, and Joshua and all of Israel made as if they were beaten before them and fled by the way of the wilderness. Verse 16, and all the people that were in Ai were called together to pursue after them. And they pursued after Joshua and drawn away from the city. Verse 17, and there was not a man left in Ai or Bethel that went not after Israel. And they left the city open and pursued after Israel. So both Ai and Bethel, you know, and Bethel I think means, I forget what it meant here, but El means of God. Or at least of Baal. And they, essentially, there's these two cities. They're in league together. Verse 18. And Yahweh said unto Joshua, stretch out the spear that is in your hand toward Ai, for I will give it into your hand. And Joshua stretched out the spear that he had in his hand toward the city. So essentially, here he goes with his hand carrying his spear. He stretched out his arm full length with the spear, pointing it to Ai. Verse 19, the ambushers rose quickly out of their place, and they ran as soon as he had stretched out his hand, and they entered the city and took it, and hastened to set the city on fire. Verse 20, and when the men of Ai looked behind them, they saw, and behold, the smoke of the city ascended up to heaven, and they had no power. It says they had, you know, power. It said they had no ability to flee this way or that. And the people that fled to the wilderness turned back upon the pursuers. So here they were. Here they were. They were crushed. They were crushed. They'd gone ahead and they seen their city burning and knew that their wives and their children were being killed by these Israelites, being burnt alive. And they had no power to do anything. Now, is this cruel of Yahweh? And the answer is no. Because Yahweh has decided that certain people, they live because they are the cares. They live for a short time, but not for, you know, but not forever. And essentially, the only purpose of the tares is to make the wheat, the children of Israel, better than they would be by themselves. Okay, I'm looking at something right now. Okay.
Hey, listen, I want to get, I mean, that sounds like Dewey Tucker's interpretation. I don't believe Yahweh ever meant for evil to exist. I think all the evil comes from Satan. And I want to get Gary's take on this while we got a good pause and what you just described, because if Eve had not slept with Satan and made Cain, there would be no serpent seed race. You would still have Satan and the fallen angels causing problems. And remember, outside of Satan, Azazel, the top devil, all the other fallen angels mated with women, but all of their offspring were giants, and they were destroyed. They were killed off. Only Satan's children got to survive the flood, his son Cain and his descendants, the tares. But if Eve had not slept with Cain, or if Adam had been given the divorce laws and he could have divorced her and waited on another pure white woman to start a pure white race family through Adam, instead, if he had waited, then Yahweh would have destroyed Satan and Eve if Adam had been given the choice of the divorce laws. But what I'm getting at, it couldn't have been Yahweh's original plan for Satan to have been created. After the fact, then there's a warfare of good versus evil through the children of darkness. But before that, you have good versus evil of Yahweh versus the fallen angels. But what I'm saying is, based on his choice and based on Adam's lack of divorce laws, he was stuck with a polluted womb to make a white race through Seth and on down. But what I'm saying is that couldn't have been Yahweh's plan. Yahweh couldn't have been happy with creating Adam's line through a polluted womb. Okay. Now, Gary, I know Dewey Tucker and Martin and I disagreed on this a long time ago on the radio show before you ever got on here. I want your opinion, Gary. Do you think evil comes from Satan, or do you think Yahweh creates the evil? Because I don't believe Yahweh is capable of creating the evil. I think Satan and his people that serve him are creating and doing the evil. I mean, Yahweh is incapable of telling a lie, and we know that Satan was the father of all lies, i.e. Satan's the father of all sin, i.e. Satan's the father of all evil. Now, I want Gary's take on this.
Oh, you don't mind putting a guy in the spot, do you? I've always had a difficult time looking at these parts of the scriptures and seeing the justification in my own eye. But I refer to the book of Revelations. That's what I'm going to refer to here.
Okay.
And where he says in chapter 21, he says to the Israelites who are redeemed and saved, he says, I'm going to utterly destroy these other Israelites, your brothers, your sisters, it might be your father, whatever it is. And he turned to me, he says, I don't want you to shed one tear over this. Now, that's the day, that's maybe part of the one day that's going to be the payday someday type thing. And it's very hard for us to understand in our limited abilities, the power of our Father, Yadivahi. And I don't think he chose to do any of these things. He had to do these things because of the sin that Adam and Eve had brought upon the earth that shouldn't happen in the first place.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree with that. It wasn't the original plan, Gary. It wasn't the original plan for Satan to pop Eve's cherry and for Cain to pop out before Abel and then Seth. It wasn't Yahweh's original plan for the tares to grow up along the wheat. Remember, if you remember in the parables, they say Yahweh in a flesh body was teaching the red letters, and he's teaching the parables of the tares and the wheat. And, of course, you've got the wheat growing up, and the tares look like the wheat when they're young. Therefore, you can't go start pulling them out because you may pull the roots of the wheat out when you pull the tares out. You have to wait till they get older and time for the harvest. And remember, somebody asked, well, who did this? Who planted the tares among the wheat? Yahweh didn't do it. It said the evil one, Satan, did. Satan creates the evil. Satan creates all this. He's the father of all lies, and he gets other people to sin and to lie and believe lies. But he told the first lie to Eve. Probably he told lies way before that. Up in heaven, he conned one-third of the angels to rebel against Yahweh. That was a lie. So he was a liar from the very beginning. He was a liar in the heavens. But this idea that, Dewey Tucker says that Yahweh creates the evil and Yahweh created Satan evil. Well, I don't believe that Yahweh would have created Satan and one-third of the angels evil. I think they chose to do evil. Just like Yahweh didn't create Adam and Eve evil, Eve chose to sleep with Satan. And Adam took sloppy seconds because he wasn't given a choice. Okay? There was no divorce law. So, and they were told to wait. They had been married for about 3,000 years, and they were both virgins, and they had not had sex for 3,000 years. 3 days is 1,000 years to Yahweh. And Adam was running the whole earth for Yahweh, naming all the plants and animals, and he comes back 6 months later, and she's already pregnant by Satan, and Satan's nowhere to be found. Now, that is in the lost books, okay? This wasn't Yahweh's plan. Yahweh didn't create. I mean, Dewey Tucker believes that everything that happens is Yahweh's plan. No. Satan or a lot of other people have done stuff contrary to Yahweh's plan. I mean, it says that before
I like Dewey Tucker, but I don't agree with him. I believe that Yahweh gives both all his creation that is sentient, be they angels, or be they the sons of true men, gives them free will. They get to make a choice. Just like it says several times, when they were ratifying the covenant, choose you this day. And in the book of Joshua, Joshua says, I choose, me and my house shall serve the Lord. So I believe that Yahweh allows evil. He allows evil people. He allows the tares, the son, the spawn of Satan, to run wild. And the whole purpose of it is to give the lost and the found sheep of the house of Israel, those who have, heard the call from Christ, to choose either good or choose evil. And those who choose evil, will end up being like a Chan. They will end up taking of the cursed thing, and they shall die, they and theirs. But I believe that Yahweh, of course, allows evil, allows the evil seed line, allows evil wiggers to run wild. But sooner or later, it does indeed come to an end. Okay? So that's pretty well my take on it. I don't believe that Yahweh creates evil, but he creates creatures who can and do choose evil. And when they choose evil, they get the reward of their evil. All right?
Mm-hmm. All right.
That's the way I look at it. I don't, you know, I tend to follow the also the Comparean belief that both Cain and Abel were.
Okay.
You know,
what I'm saying is, Mark, you just got through saying, what I'm saying is, you said, okay, you just got through saying that Yahweh has the tares around to make us be better people. No, we would have a lot happier society. We'd be a lot better people if the tares had never existed. So I don't agree with that. I don't agree.
But they exist, don't they, Logan?
Yeah, but I don't think that it wasn't Yahweh's original plan, so they can't be good. I mean, the purpose of having the tares around to make us be better people, I don't believe that crap, okay?
All right, but I don't, I really can't say that I know for certain Yahweh's plan. In many cases, you have to look at the Bible.
Well, Dewey Tucker claims to know for certain all of Yahweh's plan.
Well,
he says he's got it all.
Dewey Tucker. I'm not Dewey Tucker, okay?
Yeah.
I like Dewey Tucker. I've listened to some of his videos and listened to stuff against old Finkelsheeny and Clint's Meerkat, you know, foaming at the mouth, and I have laughed at some of the things he said. I mean, I thought, you know, I think Dewey's hilarious here sometimes. And I do have a respect for Dewey's learning, but I don't agree with much of what he ends up saying, you know, saying at the end. Okay? But Logan,
well,
you gotta understand that
there are tares
among us. There are Jews, there are bad Whiggers, there are demons, and you know, generally, if you're gonna say that Yahweh is all powerful like he does here, there's a choice here. Either Yahweh is all powerful, in which case he allows this to happen for whatever reason, for whatever designs he has, or you're saying that Yahweh is not all powerful and therefore he doesn't have any control over evil people, over Jews, over the spawn of Satan, over Satan. And what I see is that Yahweh has a design and Yahweh has a purpose. And no, I don't always understand it here. I hope I get a general feeling for it. But in many cases, I can't go ahead. We're both agreed that there are tares, that there are demons, that there is Satan, that there are Jews, that they're running wild. And, you know, the answer is, well, how is that? And the answer I derive from it is that Yahweh allows it to happen for his purposes.
Well, a lot of stuff is allowed to happen, but
okay.
I'm just saying that having the tares around is not a good thing. It's not making...
Well, I don't think it's a good thing either. I mean, if it's a matter of just wishing for it, poof, should be gone.
I mean, if you look in the Old Testament, Yahweh told certain people to kill all the Canaanites. Now, a lot of time they didn't kill all the women because they kept them for concubines or whatever. But I'm just saying, we'd have been better off if they'd obeyed and killed all the Canaanites. Now, the flood didn't get them all because obviously the flood was localized. If it had been a worldwide flood, we wouldn't even have Asians and blacks and Mexicans, let alone serpent seed Cainites. I mean, we would only have pure white people. The flood was worldwide, but obviously it wasn't, was it?
Well, yeah. So, in short, these people, these creatures exist. The terrors exist. They do evil. So it exists. So, you know, why is that? And the answer is because Yahweh chooses to let it happen. And all I can think of is that it's going for a reason. I may not understand or I may not agree with Yahweh's reason. But on the other hand, that is the reality. I don't worry too much about what I wish things would be different or better. Okay?
Well, then to... this goes back to the old Judeo church, but he also is testing the house of Jacob, Israel.
Yeah.
It's a test every day of our life that we walk. because he said in his flesh and body, he said, "You Jews are the children of hell." He says, "You traverse the whole world to find yourself one Israelite to make him a proselyte. And when you do that, you make this proselyte Israelite twice the child of hell as you are." So there's the situation. We're being tested always, all the time by proselytes, the Jews themselves, in every area of life that we walk in. It's there everywhere you walk is the Jews and the proselytes. They're out here to do the evil, and these are the ones that I believe at the day of separation, there's going to be that separation time, and that will be the last time we have to deal with the evil. Yadi Vahi is going to put him away, and that's going to be the end of all
that.
But
the thing is, hold on, the thing is, Gary, is that we're supposed to live separate. We're supposed to seek out and avoid being around the serpent seed Cainites. So all this shit about, I mean, I don't, like some of these white power people, they go out and they want to have conversations with Jews and bash Jews and get up in their face and argue with them. I don't even want to be around them. I don't even want to live among them. I don't want to argue with them. I want to avoid them. I don't want to, you know, what good is that going to do to, I mean, it's like if they're all liars, thieves, and murderers, why do you want to go argue with a liar?
I'll give you an illustration. Let me give you just a little illustration of business. If you're a farmer and you didn't inherit the whole world like some have, but they still got indebted, and you become indebted to a bad year or whatever it was, and we've had these over the years on the farmlands, and you had to go into the city to deal with these corrupt proselytes. Normally the ones you see at the bank are the proselytes that the Jews have traversed the whole world to make themselves a proselyte in the banking system.
Not
the clerks. We're talking about the people who set the loaning values out and everything. And we become subject to that because they are here and they're evil. And we know that usury is evil. It's against the laws of the Father Yadi Vahi completely. And therefore, in order to exist that one more year, and I've seen it happen over and over in the years I've lived, where a farmer got in trouble or a businessman got in trouble and he had to go to that bank, that proselyte banker, and borrow that money from the evil ones, okay? So they are amongst us, and I agree that the Father's ideal is they wouldn't be amongst us. But we have allowed...
What I'm saying is all the white nations of the earth, now that they've been integrated through these non-white immigration policies, what I'm saying is once you become racially aware, why don't you homeschool your kids and avoid and don't do business with, you know, even if you don't want to be around blacks or Asians or whatever, you don't obviously want to intermarry with them, and you want your white children to grow up with other white racial believers like you, you want to homeschool them. But what I'm saying is, why would you even want to be around Jews? Why would you, even if you know they're Satan's kids and you want to play around and argue with them and have fun with them, why would you even do that? I mean, just avoid them. Just don't even talk to them. I mean, what's the purpose? And, you know, like, you know, as far as Yahweh wants us to be tested, well, Adam and Eve were tested by Satan. But hundreds of times after they got kicked out of the Garden of Eden, they were tested all the time. Okay? I mean, if you read it, the white race today went through nothing that Adam and Eve went through. If you read the lost books, I mean, they went through all kind of hell. And then when Adam was up in the Cave of Treasures, and then Seth on down to Noah, a lot of them did leave the mountain and go race mix. Okay? But what I'm saying is, even before Cain was around, Satan was, I mean, Satan and the fallen angels were, the fallen angels too, the rest of them, not just Satan, they were tempting Adam and Eve and doing evil stuff, trying to kill. Satan actually killed Adam a couple of times, and Yahweh kept on bringing him back to life. And then one time Adam died, and then Eve jumped off a cliff, committed suicide. I mean, well, they both committed suicide a bunch. They got depressed, and I mean, even before Cain came along, was born, and all his descendants were around to tempt Adam and Eve. Satan was still there. He was a thorn in the side, and so were the fallen angels. So to say that, I mean, Yahweh could test us without the tares. So I don't think that they're necessary. Yahweh allows it, but I don't think it's, you know, I can't say it was Yahweh's original plan, because he said everything was good in the beginning until Satan popped Eve's cherry, then everything turned evil. Well, if everything was good, there was no evil, then who brought the evil? Satan and his kids. Okay, so do you say, so you think that Yahweh's original plan was to have evil? I don't think so. Yahweh's perfect. He didn't create evil. I mean, created evil.
None of us agree that he created evil. No, I don't agree with any.
Oh, Dewey Tucker does. Dewey Tucker, yes, he does. Yes, he does.
That's fine.
We ain't talking about Buddy Johnson. We're talking about Buddy Tucker. But they both live in East Tennessee. But Dewey Tucker doesn't really believe dual seed line. He don't even claim to be a two seed line anymore. And he said he tried to straighten everybody out in two seed line, and he didn't get too far. Of course, he believes Paul. He don't really put Yahweh in the red letters first. He puts Paul first. But he thinks that Dewey Tucker thinks that Yahweh created the evil. And that's what he says. And I don't believe that.
Well, I don't believe that. And I listen to you two guys. I don't believe you believe that either. So
I don't believe that. In any case,
yeah.
I do argue. I have been known to argue with you boys like Visser and Eli James and Finkelstein, though. But usually they've got to where they don't even want to talk to me anymore. So anyway, you want to go ahead and go on with.
Yeah, sure. Let's go.
Joshua chapter 8.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, verse 21, Joshua chapter 8. When Joshua and all the Israel saw the ambush had taken the city, and the smoke of the city ascended, then they turned again and slew the men of Ai. So they were caught between these two forces. Verse 22, and the other issued out of the city against them, so that they were in the midst of Israel, some on this side and some on that side, and they smote them, so that they let none of them remain or escape. So from my gallery, it was two cities, Bethel and Ai, which had pretty well got together, and they were being destroyed. Verse 23, and the king of Ai they took alive and brought him to Joshua. Verse 24, and it came to pass when Israel had made an end of slaying all the inhabitants of Ai in the field, in the wilderness wherein they chased them, and when they were all fallen on the edge of the sword until they were consumed, that all the Israelites returned unto Ai and smote it with the edge of the sword. Verse 25, so it was that all that fell this day, both the men and women, were 12,000, even all the men of Ai. Verse 26, for Joshua drew not his hand back, wherewith he stretched out the spear until he had utterly destroyed all the inhabitants of Ai. Verse 27, only the cattle and the spoil of that city Israel took for a prey unto themselves, according to the word of Yahweh, which he commanded Joshua. So I guess they didn't have, you know, racially mixed or, you know, experiments, at least with the cattle. Verse 28, and Joshua burnt Ai and made it a heap forever, even a desolation unto this day. Verse 29, the king of Ai he hanged on a tree until eventime, And as soon as the sun was down, Joshua commanded they should take his carcass down from the tree and cast it at the entering of the gate of the city, and raise therein a great heap of stones that remaineth unto this day. So they took the carcass of the king of Ai and threw it, you know, at where his gate had been, and raised a bunch of rocks there. Verse 30, then Joshua built an altar until Yahweh, God of Israel, and Mount Ebal. Verse 31, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded the children of Israel, as is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of whole stones, over which no man has lift any iron, and they offered therein burnt offerings unto Yahweh, and sacrificed peace offerings. So they had gone and created an altar of 12 stones, undressed stones, sealed stones, natural stones, you know, no iron, nothing, you know, there was no cut, there was no chisel, there was no grinding of any of the stones. You know, essentially they were whole field stones for where they made this altar. Verse 32, and he wrote there upon the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he wrote in the presence of the children of Israel. Verse 33, and all Israel and their elders and officers and their judges stood on this side the ark, and on that side before the priests of Levites, which bore the ark of the covenant of the Lord, as well as the stranger, as he that was born among them. So you still ended up having a few people who weren't quite Israelites, you know, probably some, you know, few Egyptians left. Half of them against Mount Gezerim, and half of them against Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of Yahweh, had commanded before, that they should bless the people of Israel. Verse 34, and afterwards he read all the words of the law, the blessings and cursings, according to all that is written in the book of the law. Well, when we have previously covered, specifically Deuteronomy chapter 28, the blessings and the cursings, you know, of the law. So, from what I gather, they reread more than likely that chapter and then some. Verse 35, there was not a word of all that Moses commanded, which Joshua read not before all the congregation of Israel, with the women and the little ones and the strangers that were conversant among them. And it says, by conversant, that walked among them. So that's the end of Joshua chapter 8. Okay? Right. So, from what I gather, they'd gone ahead and destroyed mainly of these Canaanites. Mainly they had destroyed Amorites. They were the blonde, blue-eyed Jews, you know, who could fool people here pretending they were white. I've seen a picture of ancient Amorites. Essentially, you can go ahead and tell that they have a bit of a nose, but it's not like the Hittite nose. It's not like the Brooklyn Jew Ashkenazi nose. It's not a huge, you know, Mark of Satan, you know, Mark of Cain honker. Their noses are a little, you know, they look a little bit more, a good deal more like white people. And it already went ahead and said that Ai, and I think Bethel, were Amorite cities. And still, you had Joshua worried about the Canaanites. He was worried about the Amorite Canaanites. Okay. Now we're going to go ahead and talk about some other Amorites. Like I said in, 2 Samuel chapter 21, as to who the Gibeonites were. Chapter 9. And what is it? 9:35. And it came to pass, when all the kings which were on this side of Jordan, in the hills, in the valleys, and in the coast of the great sea, over against Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard thereof, verse 2, that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. So essentially, here are all the bigger tribes and smaller tribes of the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, so the Canaanites, so some other, the Canaanites bred with each other. The Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard therein. They gathered themselves together. Verse 3. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done unto Jericho and to Ai, verse 4, they did work wilily. I mean, so like wily
You've heard of Wile E. Coyote? Well, they were smarter than Wile E. Coyote. They weren't just after a roadrunner either. And went and made as if they had been ambassadors and took old sacks upon their asses and wine bottles, old and rent and bound up. So they decided to pull a fast one, just like Jews do. With five, and old shoes and clouded upon their feet and old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. Verse 6, and they went to Joshua and to the camp in Gilgal, and said unto them, to the men of Israel, we be come from a far country. Now therefore, make you a league with us. So essentially they said, we're from far away. Why don't you go ahead and become our allies? Verse 7, and the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, peradventure you dwell among us, and how shall we make a league with you? So they said, well, what if you dwell, you know, what if you be Hivites? What if, you know, how can we make a deal with you? Verse 8, and they said unto Joshua, we are your servants. And Joshua said to them, who are you, and from whence come you? Verse 9, so they lied to him again. And they said unto him, from a very far country thy servants are come, because of the name of Yahweh, your God. We have heard the fame of him and all that he did in Egypt. Verse 10, and all they did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, which was at Ashtaroth. So essentially these big 12-foot giants, these Amorites, you know, these big giant, huge Amorites, one of them which was in a big old city, you know, to where Yahweh had to send hornets here and, hornets in order to drive them out of there, you know, drive them out. And then Moses dealt with them. Verse 11, wherefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke unto us, saying, take victuals with you for the journey, and go to meet them, and say unto them, we are your servants. Now, therefore, make you a league with us. Well, Moses had said, I believe in Deuteronomy chapter 19, that if you besiege a white city, you know, we're not talking about the Israelites trying to conquer Africa. We're not talking about them moving thousands of miles east and trying to conquer the Gooks. We're not talking about them crossing the oceans, you know, against the American Indians. No, 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 no. When you are besieging, when you are getting outside your normal boundaries, when you are going outside here and you come across, you know, these other white people, you besiege them. And if they give themselves up, they're going to be your slaves for three generations. They're going to draw your water and hew your wood. They're going to be your servants for three generations. Then after that, they won't be. But if they don't surrender and you have to storm the city and take casualties in taking this foreign white, you know, land, why, well, hey, you kill all the men. And you keep the little ones, you keep the little ones, and you keep the, you know, the people thereof. And the verse I'm trying to look at is called Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 10, when Moses said, when you come nigh to a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it, you know, verse 11, it shall be if it make you answer peace and open unto you, that it shall be that all the people that have found thereof shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve you. Verse 12, if they make no peace with you, but will war against you, then you shall besiege it. Verse 13, and when the Lord your God has delivered into you the hands, you smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword, but the women and the little ones and the cattle and all that is in the city, you shall take unto yourself, and you shall eat the spoil of your enemies, which, you know, Yahweh has given unto you. So this was in Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 10, verse 10 through 15. Thus you shall do to all the cities which are very far off from you, which are not of the cities of these nations. So Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 10 through 15 says that's what you do with white people who are far off. You know, as you increase in the land, as you seek out more living space, you conquer these people.
If they give up, they're going to be your servants for a time. If they don't, then you kill them and you take their wives and little ones. So, you take their, you take their virginal females and little ones. Okay? But of the cities of these people, which the Lord your God does give you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing to breathe. Okay, what city? What these? But you shall utterly destroy them. This is verse 17 of Deuteronomy 20. Namely, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. So here we are in Joshua chapter 9. And just a few years ago, Moses had caused to be read. And just a little bit earlier in Joshua, at the end of Joshua chapter 8, reread the law of Moses, all of it. And essentially, here are these people, pretend to be white people from far away. And the Israelites say, well, what if you be a bunch of Hivites? We can't make peace with you. We're supposed to kill you. Oh, no. The Gibeonites say again, we're from far away. Oh, so far away. Has anybody heard in one place? Anyway, verse 9. We're back to Joshua chapter 9. And they said to him, they're lying to him again. From a very far country, your servants are come, because they've heard of the Lord your God. And essentially, here they are quoting the law of Moses to Joshua. They just read just a couple days ago. So they go ahead, and the elders, and they said, take Rachel's with you for a journey. We will go to meet them. And said to them, we are now your servants. Therefore, now make you a league with us. So essentially, it was permitted. The Israelites hadn't even gone to besiege their city from far away. They're simply saying, hey, we're going to go ahead and serve with you against these, against these evil Canaanites. You're going to make league with us. So essentially, the Gibeonites, they want to, they're lying. They're actually little Amorite Jews here. They're Amorite Canaanites. They're lying to Joshua. Move on here. This bread we took but for our provision out of our houses on the day we come forth to go unto you, but now behold, it is dry and it is moldy. Verse 13, these bottles of wine which we filled were new, and behold, they be rent. And these our garments, our shoes, are become old by reason of the very long journey. Verse 14, the men, these Israelites, took of the rituals and asked not counsel at the mouth of Yahweh. They could have saved themselves what was going to come if they just simply asked counsel. Had Joshua gone ahead and talked to Eleazar the priest, if he just simply talked to Eleazar the priest, and then Yahweh would have said, they're Jews. They're fooling you, Joshua. They're pulling the fast one. You kill them now, kill them now, kill them now. Verse 15, Joshua made peace with them and made a league with them to let them live. And the princes of the congregation swore unto them. So essentially, Joshua and all the princes of the tribes, they cut a deal. What Yahweh says is that your vows, your deal is a deal, whether or not it works to you or not. Verse 16, it came to pass at the end of 3 days after they made a league with them that they heard they were their neighbors and that they dwelt among them. So heck, they're only what? 3 days, they figure out, they're looking for the next city of Canaanites. They find out these people they just cut a deal with are the very next city that they are to besiege. Verse 17, the children of Israel journeyed and came unto their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon and Shephirah and Be'eroth and Kirjajiarim. So there's four cities of these Amorite Gibeonites. Verse 18, the children of Israel smote them not, because the prince of the congregation swore unto them by Yahweh, God of Israel. And all the congregation murmured against the princes. The congregation said, hey, princes, you know, what sort of leadership is this? You idiots, screw it up. Right? Verse 19, but all princes said unto the congregation, we have sworn unto them by Yahweh, God of Israel. Now, therefore, we may not touch them. Remember, once you make an oath to Yahweh, you got to keep it. Verse 20, this is what we do. Well, this is the thing. They're going to go ahead and say that these Gibeonites are going to be the slaves. Verse 20, this we will do to them, because that's what Moses said to do unto them. We will even let them live, lest wrath be upon us, because of the oath which we swore unto them. Verse 21, the princes said unto them, let them live, but let them be hewers of wood and drawers of water unto all the congregation, as the princes had promised them. So essentially, they were to be slaves forever. They were to be left alive, led alive. They were not to be married into. They were to be a generation of slaves. Hewers of wood, drawers of water. Now, what are you at, Gary? Logan?
Right here.
Okay. Anyway, do you have any comments? Or should I just go ahead and go?
You're saying that some kind of deal was cut. But I don't think it was Yahweh's will whenever they went into battle to kill. I'm not talking about the Moabites or some of their relatives that were worshiping pagan gods.
Well, it turns out, if you read 2 Samuel 7:1, whenever
Israel went into battle against the Canaanites, it was not Yahweh's will to leave a man, woman, or child alive. I mean, maybe some kind of deal was cut where they could take a person.
But Logan, we're reading what it is. It is what it is. You know what I mean? They shouldn't have done that. They should have consulted. Joshua should have consulted with Eleazar before they signed an oath, before they signed a peace treaty. Should have done that. We agreed, but they hadn't. So essentially, I went back to Deuteronomy. Chapter 20, verses 10 through 17, but you know, these people were to be killed. But essentially, they were smart, cunning Jews that sort of looked white. You know what I mean? That fooled the Israelites. Okay? They fooled the Israelites. Verse 22, and Joshua called for them. He spoke of them, saying, wherefore have you beguiled us, saying, we are very far from you when you dwell among us. I wouldn't be surprised if the word beguile that he uses is much the same thing that Eve used about talking about Satan, the serpent, beguiled me. Well, essentially they seduced Israel. They pulled a fast one on them. They lied. You go ahead and read where they lied at least twice. Probably lied a lot more than that. They beguiled. Where you have beguiled us. Verse 23. Now therefore you are cursed. There shall none of you be free from being bondmen and hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. So essentially, this slavery was to last forever. It didn't. Probably within 50 years, there was a Benjamite-Israelite civil war, which much the same thing happened that happened to Ai, happened to the Benjamite cities, because they had cut a deal with these Gibeonites, and these Gibeonites had somehow wandered away from being slaves to where they were able to escape punishment for seeking homosexual sex with his Levite and cutting up his Ephraimite concubine. These Jews were supposed to be servants, and essentially they had ended up becoming masters, and the Benjamites died because of that. verse 24. And they answered Joshua and said, because it was certainly told your servants how the Lord your God commanded servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Therefore, we were sore afraid of our lives because of you and have done this thing. Verse 25, and now behold, we are in your hand, as it seems good and right unto you to do, unto us do. I mean, this was more like a Paul Dembski sort of Jew. Yeah. Well, yeah, Dembski, I've seen a picture of him. He's a short, fat, you know, blue-eyed Jew boy. He's more like an Amorite. I envision old Peerless Goodman, who looks more like a high-bite Hittite. It was a Dembski kike here. Verse 26, and so did he, Joshua, unto them, and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel, and they slew them not. So essentially, they were to be slaves forever. Verse 27, Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord, even to this day, in the place which he should choose. Well, folks, even to this day, less than 50 years later, these drawers of water and hewers of wood were essentially interfering with the justice process of Benjamin. And as a result, the Benjamites died because they allowed these Gibeonites to run wild. And later Saul got pretty well annoyed about that, 300-400 years later, and he judicially murdered a number of them. Okay? All right. Any questions about Joshua chapter 9? You're hearing now that some wily Israelite-looking, white-looking Jews, Canaanite Jews, had pulled a fast one. And they were supposed to be slaves, but they didn't stay slaves, you read later on, you know, in the Bible. All right? Any questions?
No, go ahead. Keep going.
No.
Okay. All right, Joshua chapter 10. The sun and moon stand still. This is still in Joshua chapter 88. Verse 1, now it came to pass when Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, had heard how Joshua had taken Ai. And this is the tribe of the Jebusites. And had utterly destroyed it, as he had done unto Jericho and her king, so he had done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them. Verse 2, that they feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, as one of the royal cities. And this was, you know, my royal city, it means that it was, you know, it was a major fortified place. And because it was greater than Ai, and all the men thereof were mighty. Verse 3, therefore Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, said unto Hoham, king of Hebron, and unto Piram, king of Jarmuth, and unto Japhia, king of Lachish, and unto Debir, king of Eglon, saying, verse 4, come up unto me and help me, that we may smite Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel. Verse 5, therefore the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together, went up, they and their hosts, and encamped before Gibeon, and made war against it. So essentially, they cut a deal with Gibeon, and here they are fighting. They are fighting against this big city, this big place, Gibeon, and they're going to deal with essentially these Jews that cut a deal, these Canaanites who had cut a deal with the Israelites. Verse 6, and the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua to the camp in Gilgal, saying, slack not thy hand from your servants. Come unto us quickly and save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us. Verse 7, so Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. Well, essentially, you know, what, 600,000 due to the sword? or drew the spear, and what, 30,000 of them were his elite force? Verse 8, and Yahweh said to Joshua, fear them not, for I have delivered you them into your hand. There shall not a man of them stand before you. Verse 9, Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly and went up from Gilgal all night. Verse 10, the Lord discomforted them before Israel, and slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and chased them along the way that goeth up to Beth Horon, and smote them to Zekah and unto Makeda. So, essentially, the hosts of Israel smote these five kings of the Amorites and Jebusites and the rest here, just whooped them pretty good. Verse 11, and it came to pass as they fled before Israel and were in the going down to Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down great stones from heaven upon them at Azekah, and they died. There were more which died with hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with the sword. So Yahweh sends gigantic hailstones. I mean, big rocks of ice, which can go ahead and dent a helmet. Verse 12, then spoke Joshua to Yahweh in the day which the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, sun, stand you still upon Gibeon, and you, moon, in the valley of Ajalon. Verse 13, the sun stood still, the moon stayed, till the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Jasher? Well, yeah, it's written in the book of Jasher. By the way, the little note says, next to Jasher, says the book of the upright. Okay? So I guess the scribe was known as an upright man. So remember when we were reading from Jasher? Well, pretty well, it says that, you know, from my gathering, the book of Jasher and the books of Moses and Joshua were probably fairly contemporaneous. Would that stand to reason? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hastened not to go down about a whole day. Verse 14, so that there was no day like that before it or after it, that Yahweh hearkened unto the voice of a man, for Yahweh fought for Israel. Anyway, Logan, did you hear that? Pretty well the book of Jasher is mentioned in Joshua chapter 10. Okay?
Yeah. Yeah, I have no problem with that. I mean, I don't think me and Gary have any problem with any of the lost books. And as far as Jasher, I didn't find any contradictions between Jasher and the Old Testament. What about you, Gary?
Well, I read it a long time ago, and I'm just going through it with you guys. From what I can remember and what I've, you know, freshly been brought to my mind, I don't see any difficulty between them. It's sometimes what we're taught. It's what we're told in churches that we remember. But if you study it to yourself, and as much as we're studying it tonight, I don't see any discrepancies. Okay, but that's the way I see it, and I've looked at the lost books that you're referring to, and I don't see discrepancies in that either. But however, it's very difficult to, as I've mentioned to you before, it's very very hard to speak to those lost books, because they think that the only thing that's canonized was what and they don't even know the Catholic Church did it in many, many cases, that what they brought in there. But I think the more you study scriptures, the more you don't know, but the more you do know. And when you put things together in common sense, as was taught tonight, you know, that when they made an agreement, it was in the law already. That it couldn't be changed.
Okay.
And that was very specific there. It was written in Deuteronomy. And then it was specific of what they did. Joshua made a mistake. Now, should have Joshua, as Martin said, and you said here earlier, should Joshua concurred with some of the elders? It seems like...
Well, Yahweh. You know, he should have conferred with Eleazar, and Eleazar should have asked Yahweh, and essentially they would have saved themselves a good deal of trouble, and Israel a good deal of trouble later on.
Thank you for that.
But instead they cut a deal.
Excellent, yes. And I think this pays off in our own life sometimes. We ought to stop and sit back and see what Yahweh he has to say, or Yahweh, as you say, has to say about things in other parts of Scripture. But when you limit yourself to just little tidbits and you don't want to cover the whole spectrum, it gets very difficult to understand the spectrum when you're just dealing with tidbits as you're going through. It just doesn't make common sense. And I don't like to use that word common sense because then it becomes a human thing again. But common sense will tell you that as you listen tonight to the book of Jasher, put it together with the book of Joshua, and put it together with the law. Of course, there is no law. You guys know that. And so, therefore, you couldn't use that as common sense or any judgment of Scripture. But put it together with the law, as it says there, which we all believe, then it comes to a understanding of what Joshua did. Moses did some stupid things too, and it goes to show to you that even King David, who was a man after Yahweh's own heart, look what he did. Okay, so we're all subject to this. I think there's a little lesson there to be learned there too. We are all subject to our own, how do you put it, our own theories, our own thinking. And sometimes, as I've quoted the old boy that said, it isn't what you think you know, it's what you think you know that just isn't so. And that many, many times you have to study further. Now, I have a little comment with that stranger. I will look that up, Martin and Logan, because there are four strangers. And I'll get that out some night for you when you're doing a Bible study. And maybe I can get it mailed off to you, or you can I can tell you what it is, or you can look it up. There are four different strangers. So the strangers they were talking about there tonight, I think, that you read, was the ones that were of us, and they might have been a far-off Israelites that joined. You know, but they sure were not the strangers called Nakri. Okay, they were not that stranger. So there's a Gera, okay, and on it goes. So why wouldn't they, when they put these scriptures down in English, why wouldn't they just put down the English what it really meant? No, they just use the word stranger, which further confuses people who don't study one more word. It's just one more word you got to evaluate. It's not written so we can understand, is what I'm trying to say. You follow me there?
So there's five different words for stranger.
There's four different meanings for stranger. Then you have strangers, and you have all of it. I'll try and get this all together. I don't have access to it right now, but I kind of relax when you guys are doing all the work.
Okay, that's fine.
And I appreciate it. Because
there would be a difference between, say, a racial stranger.
Yes.
And, say, someone who lives down the road who's of your own racial kind, but you don't really know them that well.
Somebody came to visit you, and he's a stranger, but he was a pure-blooded Israelite, and you were having feast days, and he could partake of feast days with you, okay? He could partake and have the same, he could have the same benefits as if he was, you know, in your area. Okay, he maybe travel. He may be one that's traveled, and he stopped at your place, and he was a stranger, but not a stranger as such as the one they call the Nakri. Okay, the Nakri proves adultery. That's the other thing it does. We don't want to get in that for it, but that anyhow. Then you got different words for strangers and everything, but we'll get to that. But that explains how the King James was put together. They could have used the word stranger and expelled on it right there, so we wouldn't have to guess at it. It's to keep us down on the farm, so to speak. Keep us deaf, dumb, and down on the farm. And I don't like to use that because I love farm, okay? But keep us deaf, dumb, and down on the farm. And this is what they've done with these scriptures. And the only way you can really understand it is you got to spend a lot more time than most of us have when we had a full-time job. You know, you have to admire people who have full-time jobs and still study these scriptures. It's a full-time job to look up and study these things, you know. But I appreciate the fact that I get to relax and listen to it. I'm blabbing a little bit now, but I get a chance to listen to it and get the reading of it and bring it all together in what I call common sense and reality for the house of Israel. And I think anybody who is an Israelite who is listening to this message got a real treat tonight. And I pray that as they develop and study the scriptures that we or whoever carries on would be a lighthouse for the house of Israel out here, explaining these verses and explaining how it's put together, because it was well done tonight, I think, and I think the contribution that Logan had and you had in this whole thing was just super, because it brought the identity of the book of Jasher with credibility. That it's mentioned one other place, I think, in Scripture. I mean, if I'm wrong, tell me. But it brings credibility.
Two places in the Old Testament and one in the New, I think.
I guess credibility in the book of Jasher.
It's mentioned a couple times directly, but it's also mentioned, like when you talk about Jannes and Jambres, who are the sons of Balaam.
Yeah.
Balaam.
By reference. It's
mentioned a couple times directly, but it's also mentioned a couple times indirectly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it gives credibility to the book of Jasher.
Just like with the book of Enoch, where it talks about these angels which left their first estate and then decided to couple with, well, essentially Adamic women. You know what I mean?
Right.
So the book of Enoch is covered to a degree as well.
Right, sure it is.
So.
Yeah. And but it gives credibility to these books that were brought up, and which, if you go back into Logan's, you know, about the Cave of Treasures and all these, and if you read them, and you know the Old Testament, the word beguiled back in the time of Eve's time meant sexually seduced. And I was going to look up that word beguiled you brought up tonight. We'll see if
well, I don't think they sexually seduced that here, but essentially by beguiled, it's sort of used that term as that you lied to us.
Yeah,
you lied and you fooled us.
Yes, yes.
Is what you did.
Well, and that's what Lucifer or Satan did to Eve. He lied to her. He lied to her. He beguiled her. He sexually seduced her. Okay. But
yeah.
That's what Strong's Cordon says. Okay, you really can't be sure what everything.
Well, I don't think Joshua was sexually seduced, but essentially he got fooled into declaring. I mean, they said, well, what if you people be Hivites?
You know, I mean, they should have been a little bit on they should have been a little bit on edge because they'd been fighting Amorites on the east bank of the Jordan. They've been fighting these, you know, they've been fighting these light colored Canaanites, and you know, as opposed to say big old hook nosed Hivites and Hethites and the rest here, you know, I mean, not all the Jews look like Sarah Silverman or Abe Foxmamser. I mean, some of them look like sort of like Leslie Stahl and Irvin Rabin here. You know, they look sort of like, they look sort of like white, Jews. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And when they get older here, the old nose grows like crazy. You know, even if they cut some off, but some of them have fooled. Some of them have fooled Israelites into breeding with them. That's why, they're talking about how Princess, Diana here, she had a little bit of what, Indian nigger in her or something like that. And this Kate Middleton, why they're talking if she squeezes out, she squeezes out a daughter, they're going to name her, they might name her Diane. So essentially what you have among the kings of England and Scotland and Wales and whatever, whatever's left of the British Isles, the main island, you end up having essentially a bunch of Jews taking over. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Kate Middleton.
Well, hasn't that happened in all the white nations of the earth, including Canada? I mean, including America. Who runs all the centers of money and all the politicians? Most of your politicians are Jews. A lot of your judges are Freemasons or Jews. All your banks are Jews. All your basically anywhere there's money and power. There may be a few proselytes here and there, but a lot of your proselytes, in order to keep their power, a lot of times they intermarry a Jew. You see what I'm saying? A lot of your, and so the next generation of that proselyte white family is going to be Jew.
Yeah, well, you've had all the the German and English and French and a whole bunch of them. I mean, they're nobility. They're leading men, just infiltrated by Jews. You know what I mean? To where essentially you're no longer being ruled by even a pure-blooded Whigger proselyte. You're being ruled by some sort of Jew Michelin. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that sort of thing does indeed happen here. In any case, I'm going to go ahead and go on real quick here. This is Joshua chapter 10, to where Joshua asked for the sun, the sun and the moon to stand still so they have extra hours of daylight to destroy these Amorite kings which have went against the Gibeonites. Verse 15 of Joshua chapter 10. And Joshua returned and all Israel with him unto the camp at Gilgal. Verse 16, but these five kings fled and hid themselves in a cave at Makeda. Verse 17, it was told Joshua, saying, the five kings are found hid in the cave at Makeda. So they were sneaking around like little foxes here, hiding out. Verse 18, Joshua said, roll great stones upon the mouth of the cave and set men by it for to keep them. Verse 19, and stay you not, but pursue after your enemies and smite the hindmost of them, and suffer them not to enter into their cities, for Yahweh your God has delivered them into your hand. So essentially, they're supposed to roll stones and put a little guard to make sure they didn't dig themselves out here, but they were to go after these king's armies and pursue them and kill them so they wouldn't be able to reach their cities and defend them. Verse 20, and it came to pass when Joshua and the children of Israel had made an end of slaying them with a great, very great slaughter, till they were consumed, but the rest which remained of them entered into fenced cities. Verse 21, and all the people returned to the camp to Joshua, Makeda, in peace. None moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel. Verse 22, then said Joshua, open up the mouth of the cave and bring out those five kings unto me out of the cave. Verse 23, and they did so and brought forth those five kings unto him out of the cave, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. Verse 24, and it came to pass when they brought out those kings unto Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said unto the captains, you know, the captains was the leaders of the chiefs, those of the men of war, which went with him, come near, put your feet upon the necks of these kings. And they came near and put their feet upon the necks of them. So essentially, he's telling these people that you have dominion over these Canaanites. You know, don't worry about them. They are humbled, and these kings couldn't do anything about it. Verse 25, Joshua said unto them, fear not, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus shall Yahweh do to all your enemies against whom you fight. Verse 26, and afterwards Joshua smote them and slew them and hanged them on five trees, and they were hanging upon the trees until the evening. Verse 27, it came to pass at the time of the going down of the sun that Joshua commanded, and they took them down off the trees and cast them into the cave wherein they had been hid, and laid great stones in the cave's mouth, which remained until this very day. So essentially, he slew them, hung them up on, you know, hung them, I guess, by their necks or by their feet or whatever. And then at evening time, they were cut down, and their carcasses were put into this cave where they hid, and rocks were put against it, and they were entombed there. Verse 28, and that day Joshua took Makeda and smote it with the edge of the sword, and the king thereof he utterly destroyed them and all the souls that were therein, and he let none remain, and thus he did to the king of Makeda as he did to the king of Jericho. Verse 29, so essentially, you know, there's this another city here, and essentially they've gone ahead and killed the men of war, so he destroyed everyone who lived in this town of Makeda. Verse 29, then Joshua passed from Makeda and all Israel with him unto Libnah and fought against Libnah. Verse 30, and the Lord delivered it also and the king thereof into the hands of Israel, and he smote it with the edge of the sword, and all the souls that were therein, he let none remain in it, but did unto the king thereof as he did unto the king of Jericho. So essentially, they're going right up these cities. Essentially, they don't probably have any fighting men left. He is essentially taking these walled cities and killing their inhabitants, putting them to the sword. Verse 31, and Joshua passed from Libnah and all of Israel with him unto Lachish and camped against it, fought against it. Verse 32, and the Lord delivered Lachish into the hand of Israel, which took it on the second day, and smote it with the edge of the sword, and all the souls that were therein, according to all they had done to Libnah. Verse 33, then Horam, king of Gezer, came to help Lachish. And Joshua smote him as people until he left them none remaining. So here's another king. He's going to help this. He's going to help Lachish. Well, he gets destroyed. Verse 34, from Lachish, Joshua passed into Eglon, and all Israel with him, and they encamped against it and fought against him. And they took it, verse 35, and they took it on that day and smote it with all the edge of the sword, and all the souls that were with him, he utterly destroyed that day according to all he had done to Lachish. Verse 36, and Joshua went up from Eglon, and all Israel with him, unto Hebron, and they fought against it. So essentially, here are all these five kings. And occasionally you have another Canaanite king decides to go ahead and help out, and Joshua destroys these cities, kills everybody in it. So essentially here's Joshua just rolling up these Amorite kings, these Jebusites, whatever. He's just going ahead and just killing them all, you know, one after the other. Sometimes it might take us 2 days to go ahead and finish up, but he's doing it. He's doing it.
Verse 37, they took it, smote the edge of the sword, and the king thereof, you know, I guess the new king thereof, and all the cities thereon, and all the souls that were therein. He left none remain, according to all they had done to Eglon, and destroyed it utterly, and all souls that were therein. So what happens is they destroyed Hebron, which was a fairly good sized, you know, which was a very good, fairly good sized Canaanite city. Remember, it's around, Hebron, where Abraham was buried, Sarah, his wife, was buried, Isaac and Rebecca were buried, where Jacob Israel was buried, and Rachel, I guess, and Leah, too. Essentially, this was a Canaanite town, but, you know, the Israelites are not, you know, being nice to the Canaanites anymore now, are they? Verse 38, Joshua returned, and all Israel with him, to Debir, and fought against it. Verse 39, he took in the king thereof, and all the cities thereof, and they smote them with the edge of the sword, and utterly destroyed all the souls that were therein, and he left none remaining, as he had done unto Hebron, so did he do to Debir, and to the king thereof, as he had done also to Libna, and to her king. Verse 40, so Joshua smote all the country of the hills and of the south and of the vale and the springs and all their kings. He left none remaining, but utterly destroyed all that breathed as the Lord God of Israel commanded. Remember, Deuteronomy chapter 20, of these tribes, don't leave anything, you know, don't leave anything breathing. Kill it all. Verse 41, and Joshua smote them from Kadesh Barnea even unto Gaza, and all the country of Goshen, even unto Gibeon. Verse 42, and all these kings in their land did Joshua take at one time, because Yahweh, God of Israel, fought for Israel. Verse 43, Joshua turned, and all Israel with him, unto the camp to Gilgal, where I think is pretty well their base of operations. Their base of operations after they had destroyed Jericho, where they circumcised people. You know, essentially he had a base here, and he was going ahead and just going in a big old circle, killing all these Canaanite kings and taking their cities and destroying them. Okay, chapter 11. So essentially it says that he's conquered the south of the land of Israel. Okay, chapter 11. And it came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, had heard these things, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Ashpath. Verse 2, and the kings who were in the north of the mountains, to the plain south of Kinneroth, and in the valley, in the borders of Dor on the west. So essentially, here is this king of Hazor. And for one year, Hazor is to the north. It's on the north side of the west bank. So essentially, Joshua has pretty well cleared out, and here is Hazor. Hazor was around, it was north of the Sea of Galilee. It was right around these, you know, this little bitty lake here called the Waters of Merom. Okay? So essentially, Joshua's crossed in, you know, crossed into Gilgal, which is just, you know, very south. Gilgal is just before the Jordan enters the Dead Sea. You know, it's around Jericho. It's when they crossed. You know, they conquered Jericho, and since Gilgal is around there, and you see Ai and Bethel. I'm looking at this map here. Gilgal, there's another Gilgal in the hill country of Ephraim. Essentially, what they did is they conquered the hill country of Judah and Ephraim and perhaps Simeon all the way to Gaza, it said. So pretty well they conquered the southern portion. But Hazor is north of the Sea of Galilee, around the waters of Merom. So essentially it's a little lake. It's a little lake before it goes and enters. It looks like it's about 2 or 3 miles wide. It's a small little lake north of the Sea of Galilee. Okay? It's called back then the Sea of Chinnereth, you know, by the waters of Merom. And you have Kadesh, which is also known as Megiddo. So essentially, here are these northern here are these northern Canaanites, and now they are going to war against the Israelites. And here are these other kings around there. Verse 3, and to the Canaan on the east and the west, and to the Amorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Jebusite in the mountains, and to the Hivite under Hermon in the land of Mizpah. Well, anyway, the land of Hermon, you know, Hermon was to the, Hermon was to the north here. Jerusalem, you know, the Jebusite was mainly around Jerusalem. So let's see, where is that here? Anyway, this is more towards central. This is more towards central, west bank of Jordan here. So essentially the northern and the central Canaanites are now going to fight. Verse 4, and they went out, they and their all their hosts with them, much people, even until sand is upon the seashore in Motu, with many horses and chariots, very many. Verse 5, when all these kings were met together, they came and pitched together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. Well, the waters of Merom is this little bitty lake north of the Sea of Galilee. So, essentially, here is Joshua. He's mopped up, you know, south central, you know, west bank. Now they're fighting against the northern portion of the west bank. You know, probably, you know, these people who are, when I'm looking at this here, these people were what, all about maybe 30, 40, 50 miles north, okay? Verse 6, and these people have chariots. Verse 6, and Yahweh said to Joshua, be not afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up all slain before Israel. You shall hawk their horses and burn their chariots with fire. Now, someone asked what the word H-O-U-G-H meant. What it meant was that you would take, you know, the tendons, especially on their back legs, and you would slice that tendon to where essentially the horse would be lamed, would be permanently lamed. Because once that tendon was cut, maybe it could be healed, but, you know, essentially you wouldn't worry about killing the horse. You just simply cut its tendons. You'd hamstring it at the very back. Okay?
It was pretty useless after that. I mean, it was almost as good as killing it.
Well, they probably killed it later on. You know what I mean? I mean, the horse, you know, the horse was not something they would eat. And if you'd gone ahead and essentially these are chariot horses. These are not cavalry horses. These are chariot horses. Okay? So, moving on here. Verse 7, so Joshua came and all the people of war with him against them by the waters of Merom suddenly, and they fell upon them. Verse 8, and Yahweh delivered them into the hand of Israel, who smote them and chased them unto great Zidon. Well, Zidon was the oldest son of Canaan. He was also known as Sidon, and essentially he formed a city. Now, usually the Phoenicians were more like trade Jews. They were more like mercantile Jews. They were more like navy Jews. They really weren't known for being great infantry, you know, infantry fighters, but I guess they were along in there too. And unto Mizrephim, until the valley of Mizpeh eastward, and they smote them until they left them none remaining. Verse 9, and Joshua did unto them as Yahweh bid him. He housed their horses and burnt their chariots with fire. Verse 10, and Joshua at that time turned back and took Hazor and smote the king thereof with the sword. For Hazor there, you know, before time was head of all those kingdoms. Well, this is way north. This is even north of the Sea of Galilee. Verse 11, and they smote all the souls that were with them with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There were not any left to breathe, and he burnt Hazor with fire. Verse 12, and all the cities of these kings and all the kings of them did Joshua take and smote them with the edge of the sword, and he utterly destroyed them as Moses the servant of Yahweh commanded. Verse 13, but as for the cities which stood in their strength, let me see, on their heap, Israel burned none of them save Hazor only, that did Joshua burn. Verse 14, all spoil these cities and the cattle of the children of Israel took for them a prey unto themselves, but every man they smote with the edge of the sword until they destroyed them. Neither left they any to breathe. So essentially, they were all wiped out, which is what Moses commanded. Moses commanded that these Canaanites, you know, were to be destroyed. And not only did it be destroyed, but everyone, you know, everything that breathed was to be destroyed. Huh? Okay. Anyway, Roxy wanted me to do something. Verse 16. So Joshua took all our land, the hills and all the south country and all the land of Goshen and the valley and the plain and the mountain of Israel and the valley of the same. Verse 17, even from the Mount Halak, which goes unto Seir, even to Baal-Gad in the valley of Lebanon under Mount Hermon, and all their kings he took and smote them and slew them. Verse 18, Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. Verse 19, there was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All other they took in battle. Verse 20, for it was of the Lord to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might destroy them utterly, and that they might have no favor, but that he might destroy them, as Yahweh commanded Moses. Verse 21, at that time came Joshua and cut off the Anakims from the mountains. The Anakims were these giants. They were these big Rephaim. There were these giants. And the Anakim, remember when it was told that these Anakim would make us look like little grasshoppers? From Hebron, and from Debir, from Anath, and from all the mountains of Judah, and from all the mountains of Israel, Joshua destroyed them utterly with their cities. So these giants, these huge, spawn of the watchers, you know, and their descendants here, these big giants. Now, there are some of them left among the Philistines. And essentially, Yahweh was not against the Philistines because they were not Canaanites. They were a white, Adamic sort of people who could be bred with, but and there were some giants left. But here's Joshua. He's killing these Anakim, these giants from the mountains, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, from all the mountains of Judah, from all the mountains of Israel. See, there was the hill country of Judah, and there was a hill country of Ephraim, where they're talking about Mount Ephraim. Joshua destroyed them utterly with their cities. Verse 22, there was none of the Anakims left in the land of the children of Israel, only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod there remained. So essentially the Canaanite giants were killed. The only ones that were left were these Anakim giants, you know, these freaks here, you know, in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod, which were three of the five major cities of the Philistines. They were remaining, and later on, they were killed during the time of David. And then after that, there were none left, at least none that we hear of. Verse 23, so Joshua took the whole land according to all that Yahweh said to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance unto Israel, according to their divisions by their tribes, and the land rested from war. So, anyway, chapter 12 is a list of these cities, of these towns, you know, including Jerusalem, Jarmuth, Eglon, Debir, Hormath. Joshua chapter 10, 11 consists of these Canaanite kings, just like on the east bank, they unilaterally went out of their cities and attacked Israel. They went out of their fortified cities, and they attacked Israel. And the northern Canaanites had war chariots. They had horses and war chariots. But still, they were destroyed, nevertheless, were they not? So that is pretty well. And from what I hear in the book of Jasher, it said that the main fighting took about 5 years. Anyway, In Joshua chapter 12, you have a list of the conquests here. The kings of the land. You know, there was Sihon, king of the Amorites, who did, you know, and then there was Og from the river Arnon to Mount Hermon. All the plain on the east. Well, essentially that was conquered under Moses. So from the plain of the sea to Chinneroth on the east unto whatever, and the coast of Og, king of Bashan. Well, they were destroyed. On Mount Hermon, they were destroyed, the Gezerites, and they talk about the boundaries in Joshua chapter 6. Then Moses, the servant of Yahweh, and the children of Israel smote, and Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave for a position to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half tribe of Manasseh. Okay, verse 7. These are the kings of the country which Joshua and the children of Israel smote on this side Jordan on the west. From Baal-Gad in the valley of Lebanon, he went to the Mount Halak, which goes up to Seir, which Joshua gave unto the tribe of Israel for possession, according to their division. They conquered all the way from Lebanon, all the way down to where it almost goes up to Seir. So they conquered pretty well, like they said, on the east bank from Dan to Beersheba. Verse 8, in the mountains and the valleys and the plains and the springs and the wilderness and the south country, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and Jebusites. The king of Jericho, the king of Ai, which is beside Bethel, the king of Jerusalem, Jarmuth, Eglon, Gezer, Debir, Hormath, Libna, Makeda, Tapua, Hefer, Aphek, Lecher, Madon, Hazar, Shimeoth, Atzaphath, Te'anach, Megiddo. Essentially, Megiddo is the same as Kadesh here. You've heard of Armageddon? Essentially, Kadesh, Megiddo was where essentially you had an east-west route, but you also had the major highway which went up the Mediterranean coast, and there in 1275, Ramses, king of Egypt, and these Hittites under their Neo-Hittite empire had a clash here, and this was during the time of the judges. The king of Kadesh, the king of Kedem of Carmel, the king of Dor, and the coast of Dor, the king of the nations of Gilgal, the king of Tirzah, and said essentially all their kings, 30 in one. So 31 kings, 31 major cities were destroyed. Okay. Chapter 13. And I'm going to go ahead and call it a night at 11. Essentially, we'll have gone ahead and done about close to 3 hours. Program. I doctored Roxy earlier, so we're gonna have a 3 hour show tonight. Okay. Joshua chapter 13. Now Joshua was old, stricken in years, and Yahweh said unto him, "You are old and stricken in years, and there remains yet very much land to be possessed." Verse 2. This land that remains, all the borders of the Philistines and all Geshurai, from Sihor, which is before Egypt. Which is, essentially, from around the Sinai Peninsula, even to the borders of Ekron northwards, which is counted to the Canaanite, 5 lords of the Philistines, the Gazerites, the Ashdodites, the Eskimoanites, the Gittites, and the Ekronites, also the Avites. Essentially, from what I gather, the Philistines, they were to be conquered too, but they were not necessarily to be destroyed. They were not Canaanites. Verse 4, from the south all the land of the Canaanites and Menorah, which is beside the Sidonians, unto Aphek, to the borders of the Amorites. Essentially, the Sidonians were Lebanon. They were, Lebanon, up to Lebanon was to be conquered essentially from, Dan to Beersheba. And he's pointing out, in the case of the Philistines, they were not necessarily to be destroyed, but they were to be besieged. And they were to be brought under tribute if they gave in. If they didn't give in, you killed all the men, and you enslaved the women and, you know, took their little ones. So essentially, you know, the Philistines were to be dealt with, and they still had some giants. From the south, all the land of the Canaanites, and Medad, which is the, okay, under Aphek, and the land of the Giblites and all Lebanon to the sunrise, and from Belgad unto Mount, under Mount Hermon, unto the entering, unto Hamath. So pretty well all Lebanon, you know, or at least south Lebanon. Let's see, all the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon unto Mizrahim and all the Sidonians, them will I drive out from before the children of Israel, only divide you it by lot to the Israelites for an inheritance, as I've commanded you. So essentially the Sidonians, they were Canaanites, and they were to be driven out. Now the city of Sidon wasn't, I don't think it was actually mentioned, it was somewhat outside, but they had borders from Sidon leading in. And that was to be taken and destroyed. Verse 7. Now therefore divide this land for inheritance unto nine tribes and the half tribe of Manasseh. Verse 8. With whom the Reubenites and Gadites have received their inheritance, which Moses gave them beyond Jordan eastward, even as Moses the servant of the Lord gave them. And it goes on from, you know, from this other place here. About this is west, this is the east bank from the Arnon to the cities of Sihon, Gilead, the Bashan, the kingdom of Og. Let's see, verse 13. Nevertheless, the children of Israel expelled not the Geshurites nor the Maacites, but the Geshurites and the Maacites dwell among the Israelites unto this day. Verse 14, only unto the tribe of Levi he gave none inheritance. The sacrifices of Yahweh God made by fire are their inheritance, as he said unto them. Verse 15, Moses gave unto the tribe of the children of Reuben inheritance according to families. So it goes ahead and tells how the land is to be, you know, is to be delivered here. And it goes ahead and talks on more on Joshua chapter 13 about the West Bank. So, about the Gadites, the Manassehites, and the rest here. Okay, chapter 14 of the book of Joshua. These are the countries which the children of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel distribute for inheritance to them. By lot was their inheritance, as Yahweh commanded by the hand of Moses, for the nine tribes and for a half tribe. Goes on, says that Moses has already let two and a half tribes, you know, divvy it up on the east bank. Okay, so let's see. Verse 4, for the children of Joseph were two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim. Therefore they gave no part to Levites and land save cities to dwell in with their suburbs for their cattle or for their substance. They divide the land. Children of Judah came unto Joshua and Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said unto him, you know the thing that the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee in Kadesh Barnea. Verse 7, 40 years old. This is to Caleb. This is to Caleb. They came to Joshua in Gilgal, and his fellow scout, Caleb, was there. You know, verse 7, 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of Yahweh, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought him word again, as it was in my heart. Verse 8, nevertheless, my brethren that went with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly follow Yahweh, my God. Verse 9, Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the Lord, wherein your feet have trodden, shall be your inheritance and your children forever, because you have wholly followed Yahweh, your God. Verse 10, and now behold, Yahweh has kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, even since Yahweh spoke this word unto Moses, while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. And lo, I am this day 84 years old. So he's 85 years old. Essentially, he spied it out, 45. Essentially, the conquest, the main conquest, there was still some left, took 5 years. Verse 11, and yet I am as strong this day as I was the day that Moses sent me. As my strength was then, even so is my strength now for war, both to go out and to come in. Verse 12, now therefore give me this mountain whereof the Lord spoke on that day, for thou hearest in that day how the Anakims were there, and the cities were great and fenced. If so be, but Yahweh will be with me, then I will be able to drive them out, as Yahweh said. Verse 13, and Joshua blessed him and gave unto Caleb, the son of Jephunneh of Hebron, for an inheritance. So essentially there were these giants living around Hebron, these Anakim. Verse 14, Hebron therefore became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, to this day, because he wholly followed Yahweh, God of Israel. Verse 15, the name of Hebron before was Kirjon Arba, which Arba was a great man among the Anakims, and the land had rest for more. So essentially, Arba was a great man, among the Anakim. I've been reading these novels by this Brian Godwa, and he takes a bunch of stuff from the Book of Jasher, and oh, it sounds more like Stephen Cantrell than, you know, than the Book of Jasher here. But essentially, from what I gather, Caleb, when he was 85 years old, he went ahead and fought around Hebron these giants, and he defeated them. So, chapter 15 was the land of Judah. So this was the border that was given the Judeans, and I'm not going to really read that here. But you have cities which became sort of famous, like Ziklag, which was sort of among the Philistines, and from Ekron and Ashdod. And chapter 15 was what was given the Judeans. Chapter 16 was what was given the Ephraimites. Now, the Ephraimites, there were major tribes here, and the Ephraimites had gotten the double portion of Joseph's double portion. So Ephraim was one of the more mightier tribes, and was actually the leader of one of the divisions, you know, along with Manasseh, along with Benjamin. And during the years of the wilderness wandering, the houses of, well, essentially the houses of the sons of Joseph and Benjamin, you know, of Rachel, were pretty well one part of the three tribes. Later on, Benjamin clave unto Judah, but Ephraim was Judah was the mightiest single tribe, but after that, the next mightiest single tribe was the land, was the tribe of Ephraim. Verse 17, the land of Manasseh. Manasseh was a half tribe here, okay? The rest had it in Gilead, and they talks about the land of Manasseh, the other half-tribe. It was from Asher. It was around Asher and Naphtali. So it goes ahead and tells in chapter 17 in the case of Ephraim, in Joshua chapter 16. Verse 10, and they drove not out the Canaanites that dwell in Gezer, but the Canaanites dwelled among the Ephraimites unto this day, and served unto tribute. So they did not destroy. The Ephraimites did not utterly destroy these Canaanites who lived in Gezer. You know, chapter 17, land of Manasseh. You know, verse 12, yet the children of Manasseh could not drive out the inhabitants of those cities, and the Canaanites would dwell in their land. Verse 13, came to pass when the children of Israel were waxed strong, they put the Canaanites to tribute, but did not utterly drive them out. Verse 14, the children of Joseph spoke unto Joshua, saying, why have you given me but one lot and one portion to inherit, seeing I am a great people, for as much as Yahweh has blessed me hitherto? Verse 15, Joshua answered to them, Joshua was of the tribe of Ephraim. So essentially they're bitching to a man who was essentially the leader of all Israel, but of their tribe. Verse 15, Joshua answered them, well, if you be a great people, then get you up to the wood country and cut down for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and of the giants, if Mount Ephraim be too narrow for you. Verse 16, the children of Joseph said, the hill is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites that dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron, both they which are of Beth Shean and her towns, and they are of this valley of Jezreel. Verse 17, Joseph spoke unto the house of Joseph, even unto Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, you are a great people, have great power. You shall not have one lot only. Verse 18, but the mountain shall be yours, for it is a wood, and you shall cut down, and the outgoings of it shall be yours, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots, and though they be strong. So essentially, here are the tribes of Joseph, Ephraim, and half tribe of Manasseh, and says, well, we'd be a strong tribe. Why did you only give us one lot here? And he says, well, hey, you can have this woods. Drive them out. Drive out these Canaanites. Well, they didn't. It says so. Verse 18, the tabernacle set up at Shiloh. So let's see here. I'm looking at this here. Okay. Anyway, I'm sort of wandering around fairly quick here in order to go ahead and cover the book of the book of Joshua for the next couple minutes here. The tabernacle was set up in Shiloh. Okay? And Joshua, they've had 5 years of war. They're divvying up the land, but they're not destroying all the Canaanites. And, the whole congregation and the children of Israel, assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle with congregation there, and the land was subdued before them. Verse 2, and there remained among the children of Israel 7 tribes which have not yet received their inheritance. So essentially, Judah and Ephraim and half the tribe of Manasseh had received it. Verse 3, and Joshua said to the children of Israel, how long are you slack to go to possess the land which Yahweh has given you? Verse 4, give out from each among you 3 men for each tribe, and I will send them, and they shall rise and go through the land and describe it according to the inheritance of them, and they shall come again to me. And they shall divide it into 7 parts. Judah shall abide in their coast on the south, and the house of Joseph shall abide in their coast on the north. So essentially, there was already becoming a division between Judah and the rest of Israel, between the house of Ephraim. And you go ahead and find out later that Jeroboam was of the tribe of Ephraim. So there was a conflict between the house of Joseph, a.k.a. Ephraim and Manasseh, but mainly between Ephraim and Judah. Verse 6, you shall live this. Describe the land in 7 parts, bring me the description, I may cast lots for you here. So essentially, Judah and Ephraim were essentially the two rocks here. Were the two rocks of which the Israelites would assemble. And essentially, you have 7 tribes left here. Verse 7, but the Levites have no place among you, for the priesthood of the Lord is their inheritance, and Gad and Reuben, half tribe, have already received their inheritance. Verse 8, and the men arose and went away, and Joshua charged them and went to describe the land, saying, go walk through your land and describe it. Come again to me, that I may there cast lots for you before Yahweh in Shiloh. So the men went and passed through the land, described it by cities in 7 parts in a book, came again to Joshua and the host at Shiloh. Verse 10, and Joshua cast lots for them and Shiloh before the Lord, and there Joshua divided the land into the children of Israel according to their divisions. So it says in, you know, verse 11, a lot of the tribe of the children of Benjamin, they came up, and they came forth essentially between Benjamin was brought in between Judah and the children of Joseph, i.e. they were between Judah and Ephraim. So it says what their border was. It goes on here. The border came down. It goes ahead and says what the border was here. And Jordan was the border of it on the east side. And, you know, pretty well it goes ahead and says, you know, how they've gone ahead and divided. The rest of the land here, they came to Simeon. And remember, Simeon was essentially cursed that they would be scattered among Israel. Well, Simeon was given land not with the rest of Israel, but was given land to the south of Judah. And that was, I think that was designed to try to get around that, you know, particular curse. But later on, they were scattered and absorbed within the rest when Judah and Israel split. And most of the split of Israel occurred under Ephraim. So they go ahead and they divide, and it's the inheritance of Simeon, you know, chapter 19 is the inheritance of Simeon. Okay, it says in, you know, verse 9 of chapter 18, out of the portion of the children of Judah was the inheritance of the children of Simeon, for the part of the children of Judah was too much for them. Therefore, the children of Simeon had their inheritance within the inheritance of them. And the third lot came up for the children of Zebulun. It tells where their borders were. And let's see, verse 17, the fourth lot came out to Issachar for the children of Issachar, according to their families. It tells where their inheritance was. Okay, Joshua chapter 19. The fifth lot came for the tribe of children of Asher, according to their families, and there tells where their border was. Okay, verse 32 of Joshua chapter 19, the sixth lot came to children of Naphtali, and theirs was toward the north. And let's see, and Iron and Migdal, you know, Migdalel and whatever. Okay, the seventh lot came to the tribe of Dan, and it tells where their land was here. Verse 47. Joshua chapter 19, the coast of the children of Dan went out too little for them. Therefore the children of Dan went up to fight against Lashem and took it, smote the ledge of the sword and possessed it and dwelt therein, and called Lashem Dan after the name of Dan their father. This is the inheritance of the children of Dan. Verse 49, when they had made an end of dividing the land for inheritance by their coast, the children of Israel gave an inheritance to Joshua the son of Nun, according to them. Verse 50, according to the word of the Lord, they gave the city which he hath, even Timnath-Serah and Mount Ephraim, and he built the city and dwelt therein. Verse 51, these are the inheritance which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the fathers of the tribe of the children of Israel divided for inheritance by lot in Shiloh before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. So they made an end of dividing the country. All right, folks, what they had done is of the nine and a half tribes, first they decided where Judah would be. Then they decided where Ephraim and the half tribe of Manasseh would be. And the half tribe of Manasseh would be to the north of Ephraim. Essentially, the two big tribes, Judah and Ephraim, got the first choice here. Simeon, they tried to keep Simeon from being scattered, so they put Simeon to the south of Judah. And the end result was that Simeon got scattered nevertheless here among all of Israel. And then the rest of it, there were seven tribes left here, and they divided by lot. And then they, you know, you go ahead, read in Joshua chapter 19, how the land on the west bank of the Jordan, the land of Canaan, from Dan to Beersheba, from later on you read in the book of the Judges that Dan didn't actually conquer some of what they were supposed to get, so they went ahead and killed some relatively mild Sidonian people. And pretty well the name of that was on the west bank of the Jordan. It was from Dan to Beersheba, where Isaac dwelt, that we read about in the book of Jasher, where the wells were necessary to be dug, which, because it was close to the essentially the Sinai, the Sinai wilderness. Okay. Verse 20, the Lord also spoke to Joshua, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, point out of you cities of refuge, wherewith I spoke to you, you know, by the hand of Moses, and slay that kills any person unaware and unwittingly may flee thither. And he will go ahead and in there, and they'll judge this thing of the avenger of blood. And folks, you got to realize, Israel did not have a police force. If someone went ahead and killed your brother, you were the avenger of blood. This was self-help justice. It was very much a matter of feuding. So essentially, if someone went ahead and killed somebody accident, he had to run to these cities of refuge. And how they did that is that there were, you know, they would go and judge whether or not this was a accident or whether it was murder. Verse 7, they appointed Kadesh in Galilee, in the Mount Naphtali, and Shechem in Mount Ephraim. You know, Shechem was a major city in Ephraim. And, you know, Hebron in Judah. And on the other side of Judah, they signed Bezer in the wilderness out of Reuben, and Ramoth in Gilead out of the tribe of Gad, and Golan and Bashan of the tribe of, you know, the half tribe of Manasseh. So essentially there were three cities, each on each side of the Jordan, which were the suburbs of the Levites and also the cities of the refuge, you know, of refuge here. Okay. Chapter 21. There were also 48 other cities of the Levites. Then came the heads of the fathers of the Levites, unto Eleazar the priest, unto Joshua son of Nun, unto the heads of the fathers of the tribe, and they spoke unto them, the Lord commands by the hand of Moses to give us cities to dwell in, the suburbs thereof, for our cattle. And the children of Israel gave unto the Levites out of their inheritance at the commandments of Yahweh these cities from their suburbs. So they divided among the Levites in Joshua chapter 21. What did they say? 42 cities or something like that here? So every tribe gave up some town on both sides. Okay? So essentially in Joshua chapter 21, verse 43, and Yahweh gave unto Israel all the land which he swore to give to their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein. Verse 44, Yahweh gave them rest round about according to which he swore unto their fathers, there stood not a man of all their enemies before them, and Yahweh delivered all their enemies into their hand. Verse 45, there failed not aught of any good thing which Yahweh had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass. So, 22, chapter 22, there is an altar, essentially, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh is essentially turned loose because now they've conquered the land of Canaan. They are no longer necessary. It's time for them, their fighting men, to go home across the Jordan. And they build an altar. They build an altar, and people are worried about that. And Phinehas goes ahead. So, in verse what? Joshua chapter 22, they explained They explain why they're doing this here. They said to the heads of the thousands of Israel, the Lord of gods, he knows that if it be a rebellion or transgression against the Lord, save us not this day, that we build us an altar to turn from following Yahweh or to offer therein burnt offerings or meat offerings or if you offer peace offerings. We've not done this for fear of these things here. Why have you done this here? He said that Yahweh made Jordan a border between us and you. You children of Reuben, children of Gad, you had no part in the Lord, so shall your children make our children cease from fear in Yahweh. Therefore we said, let us now prepare to build us an altar, not for burnt offering, nor for sacrifice. Verse 27, but that it may be a witness between us and you, and our generations after us, that you might do the service of Yahweh before him with our burnt offerings, with our sacrifices, and with our peace offerings, that your children may not say to our children in time to come, you have no part in Yahweh. So essentially they built this altar. They built this altar to say that they were one people. Verse 30. And when Phinehas the priest and the prince of the congregation, the heads of the thousands of Israel which were with him, heard the words that children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the children of Manasseh spoke, it pleased them. Verse 31, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, said unto the children of Reuben, to the children of Gad, and children of Manasseh, this day we perceive that Yahweh is among us, because you have not committed this trespass against Yahweh. Now you have delivered the children of Israel out of the hand of Yahweh. Verse 32, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and the princes returned from the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, out of the land of Gilead, unto the land of Canaan, to the children of Israel, and brought them word again. Verse 33, and the thing pleased the children of Israel, and the children of Israel blessed Yahweh, and did not intend to go up against them in battle to destroy the land wherein the children of Reuben and Gad dwelt. Verse 34, and the children of Reuben and the children of Gad called the altar Ed, for it shall be a witness between us that Yahweh is God. So, in Joshua chapter 23, Joshua says, gives the words of warning. He tells the Israelites, you've gotten your inheritance. Yahweh brought us out of Egypt. I've seen leaving. I've seen the plagues. And as for me and my house, we will follow. We will follow Yahweh. But don't transgress against it. Chapter 24 is about the death of Joshua. He gathered the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders, and they presented themselves before Yahweh. And verse 2, and Joshua said unto the people, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood in old time, even Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. Well, Terah and Nahor, they did serve other gods. Verse 3, and I took your father Abraham from the other side of the flood and led him throughout all the land of Canaan and multiplied his seed and gave him Isaac. Verse 4, and I gave unto Isaac Jacob and Esau, and I gave unto Esau Mount Seir to possess it. But Jacob and his children went down into Egypt. Verse 5, I sent Moses also and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt according to that which I did among them, and afterwards I brought you out. Verse 6, and I brought your fathers out of Egypt, and you came unto the sea, and the Egyptians pursued after your fathers with chariots and horsemen unto the Red Sea. Verse 7, when they cried unto Yahweh, put darkness between you and the Egyptians, and brought the sea upon them, and covered them. And your eyes have seen what I have done in Egypt, and you dwelt in the wilderness a long season. Verse 8, and I brought you into the land of the Amorites, which dwelt on the other side Jordan, and they fought with you, and I gave them into your hand that you might possess their land, and I destroyed them from before you. Verse 9, then Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, arose and warred against Israel, and sent and called Balaam the son of Beor to curse you. Verse 10, but I would not hearken unto Balaam, therefore he blessed you still, so I delivered you out of his hand. Verse 11, you went over Jordan and came unto Jericho, and the men of Jericho fought against you, the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Girgashites, the Hivites, and Jebusites, and I delivered them into your hand. Verse 12, and I sent the hornet before you, which drove them out from before you, even the two kings of the Amorites, but not with thy sword, nor with thy bow. Well, what he's talking about in chapter 12 is that one of these giant kings of the Amorites, I'm not sure it was Sihon or Og, he had fortified cities built into the rock, and normally the Israelites would not be able to handle them. But what he did is he sent a hornet. He sent this, wave of hornets. Remember what I was telling you about this? Essentially, I imagine there was another book other than Jasher here which told about this. He said he sent the hornet. He used hornets to drive out one of these giant kings out into the open so that Moses and the rest could go ahead and fight and destroy them. Verse 13, and I've given you a land which you did not labor, and cities which you built not, and you dwelt in them. Of the vineyards and olive yards which you planted not, do you eat. Verse 14, now therefore fear Yahweh and serve him with sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve you the Lord. Now when he says on the other side of the flood, Nahor and Terah, they lived on the same side of the flood as the Israelites did, but they served. Remember? They served gods. Terah, who was Abraham's father, was an idol maker. He was of the good line, but he did not do good. He was an idol maker. This was not a good thing. All right? Okay, looks like I have a little bit of problem with the computer here.
Hey Mark, I'm gonna call it a night. I'm gonna let you Gary finish it out.
I'm gonna go ahead and finish reading the last of the verse here. If Gary wants to call it a night, that's fine here. This is Joshua chapter 24, and this will be the last of the book of Joshua. So I did want to cover it tonight here. But I'll let you go here, and I'll have a show Thursday, and you can be there, and you can figure out what we're going to do Friday, okay?
Yeah, sounds good. All right, I'll talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye. Gary, did you catch that?
I got it.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and finish reading the book of Joshua, and then what I'm going to do after that is I'm going to go ahead and call it a night after that, okay?
Okay, me too.
All righty here. Verse 14, now therefore fear Yahweh and serve him in sincerity and in truth. Let me see. Okay, well, I end up losing, but it looks like we got more people here. I guess they finally figured out we were doing that here. Verse 14, now therefore fear Yahweh and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye Yahweh. Verse 15, if it seem evil unto you to serve Yahweh, choose you this day who you will serve, where the gods which your which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Well, this is what Joshua was saying. Him and his house would serve Yahweh. Verse 16, the people answered and said, Yahweh forbid that we should forsake Yahweh to serve other gods. Verse 17, for the Lord our God, it is that brought us up and our fathers out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, and which did those great signs in our sight and preserved us all the way wherein we went, and from among all the people through whom we passed. Well, you got to realize
some of these people here would have been children. Maybe up until, 19 years old here. They would have lived, they would have seen, being slaves. Essentially, when they crossed over Jordan, they might have been 60 years old. And here it was, 28 years here? Some of them might very well have lived to be 80 or 90 or 100. So some of them very well had seen, it was within living memory, had been slaves in Egypt, had been underneath the age of 20 when Israel rebelled, had lived through 40 years, and had lived through another, 25, 26 years of the conquest of Canaan. So they would have been, not quite 20, and then another 40, there had been 60 or so. And then, there was been some who would have been 86 years old. Probably the oldest ones would have been 86 years old when Joshua was telling them this here. So it was within their memory what had happened. Okay, this point I'm trying to make here, is that some of them, the older ones, admittedly, had been slaves, had been put to work as children, in Egypt, and had seen, had picked the manna, had survived the flights of, had survived the flight of, had survived the quail and the biting snakes, and hadn't rebelled, essentially, probably murmured a little bit, but essentially this was the end of a generation. This was a passing of Joshua. By this time, the man is 85, 86 years old. Verse 18, and Yahweh drove out before us all the people, even the Amorites, which dwelt in the land. Therefore will we also serve Yahweh, for he is our God. Verse 19, Joshua said unto people, you cannot serve Yahweh, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions nor your sins. Verse 20, if you forsake Yahweh and serve strange gods, then he will turn and do you hurt and consume you. After that, he has done you good. Verse 21, the people said unto Joshua, no, but we will serve Yahweh. Verse 22, and Joshua said unto the people, you are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen you, Yahweh, to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses. Verse 23, now therefore put away, said he, the strange gods which are among you, and incline your heart unto the Lord God of Israel. Verse 24, and the people said unto Joshua, Yahweh our God will we serve, and his voice will we obey. Verse 25, so Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and set them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. Shechem was this big, main city. It was a city of refuge in Mount Ephraim. Verse 26, and Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of Yahweh, took a great stone and set it up for there under an oak that was by the sanctuary of Yahweh. Verse 27, and Joshua said unto all the people, behold, the stone shall be a witness unto us, for it has heard all the words of Yahweh which he spoke unto us. It shall be therefore a witness unto you, lest you deny your God. Verse 28, so Joshua let the people depart, every man unto his inheritance. Verse 29, it came to pass after these things that Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of Yahweh, died, being 110 years old. So, folks, you would have had some people, if Joshua was 40 or 42, you would have had some people be 86, 80. By the time of Yahweh, they would have been 86 to 90 years old here. Verse 30, and they buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Serah, which is in Mount Ephraim on the north side of the hill
of Gaash. Well, Joshua was an Ephraimite, verse 31. And Israel served Yahweh all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that overlived Joshua, and which have known all the works of Yahweh that he had done for Israel. There were some men, not quite as old, probably 20 years or so younger than Joshua. By the time he died, there were doubtless some of these elders that were about, what, in their late 80s, early 90s? Verse 32. And the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, buried they in Shechem, in a parcel of ground which Jacob bought of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and became the inheritance of the children of Joseph. Verse 33, and Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died, and they buried him in the hill that pertained to Phinehas, his son, which was given him in Mount Ephraim. That's the end of the book of Joshua. And pretty well, one of these days, I'm going to cover the book of Judges to where, essentially, the book of Judges is sort of like the Wild Wild West. Every man, you know, there was no king in Israel. Every man did whatever the heck he felt like it. So, you know, if you ever want to have a sort of Western, but with spears and swords and bows and arrows, why, folks, that would be a place for biblical fiction here. Anyway, Gary, I think it's probably about time.
It was so very interesting. Forgive me for interrupting you, but it's so interesting, and it was well worth the stay, and I stayed pretty alert. Through it all, and it's
I wanted to cover that this was a special generation. This was a generation, some of whom had actually been, you know, some of these men when Joshua died, you knew they were at least 20 some years younger, because they couldn't be over. They couldn't have been over. They couldn't have been. You know, they were about 19 here when their parents, the slave-born generation, died. And some of them might have been 18, 19, 17, 16. They would have been put to work. They would have had to work in the brick, you know, the brick mire and the rest. And so they had been slaves, you know, as children. And they had seen the 40 years of wilderness. They had eaten manna. And they had conquered for, what, 26 years? They'd conquered Canaan. They hadn't, you know, fully conquered Canaan, but they conquered most of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so here was this generation which had been welded into a fighting machine, and for a short time, about 20 years or so, to where essentially the last of the you know, people who had been in slavery in Egypt died. You go ahead and read it in the first book of the chat. You know, I mean, for what, 17 or 18, 19, 20 years, these people called judges, who were essentially Joshua's head men, his captains, his elders, whatever. You know, for a short time after Joshua, while this generation was still alive, this was a generation which had been purged for 40 years, who had essentially lived, you know, who had been slaves in Egypt, you know, some of the older ones, who had been born or, you know, lived for 40 years picking manna to where they didn't have any choice but to obey the Sabbath because they didn't have any choice in the matter. And essentially this was not so much a mixed multitude. This was a fighting force of, what, 600,000 footmen mainly, who had fought with Moses, and certainly fought with Joshua. And remember the point where I talked about this one, you know, when he talks about the hornet, I think it's referring to another lost book of the Bible, sort of, which went ahead and, you know, talked about how one of these Amorite kings, one of these, you know, big giants here, I'm not sure if it was Og or Sihon, had a had cities carved out of rock to where the Israelites wouldn't have been able to besiege it. And essentially, Yahweh sent hornets out to force them out. And, you know, you do indeed have. You do indeed, you know, there are other books that we have lost here. And, you know, pretty well I tend to follow the actual scripture here. I can be a little bit reluctant to follow a number of books because I don't know where they come from. But I did want to go ahead, and pretty well we've been doing this for about, what, 3, maybe 4 months. You know, comparing Jasher and the Bible together. And pretty well, I think we've pretty well come to an end of this particular series tonight here. So I wanted to get her done, pretty well get her done, and then pretty well maybe cover, either the Book of Enoch or cover, something else here. And on my Bible studies nights, I do want to cover the Book of Judges as well.
Okay.
So, yeah, I hope it was interesting here. I know
very
so
good.
Much people sort of found it tonight. I'm going to have to go ahead and log off here in order to go ahead and end the show. But anyway, Gary, I was glad to have you for, better than half the series. Since Logan went ahead and found you, I was glad to have you with it, and I was glad that, we could go ahead, me and Logan and you could have this essentially this panel discussion.
Yep. Everybody bless and good night.
Yep. And Thursday I'll have one of my shows, which is not so much biblically oriented here, where I'm fighting with Jews or whatever, which is
right.
Not as much interesting. But I'm glad that Yahweh kept your phones, your wireless phone battery working too, okay?
Yeah. Good night.
All right, good night, Gary. All right, folks, I'm going, this is pretty well the end of the show, but pretty well I'm going to have to re-log in my Tor browser in order to finish. So what I'm going to do is, it's, 11:30, so we've been, going on for 3.5 hours. This is one of the longer shows here, but I'm glad that I, got covered the Book of Joshua, so we can go ahead and pretty well end the series of comparing the Old Testament, the 5 books of Moses and Joshua to the Book of Jasher. So, folks, I'm going to go ahead and say, Hail Victory. May Yahweh bless. Good night.
You stupid thing. Well, folks, I don't know if anybody's listening. I'm going to have to reboot my computer in order to get this thing to work here. Bruce Howard asks if the Giants were evil. The answer is yes, they were evil because they were the descendants of Demon, and they were the descendants of Demon and... Demon and Adamic female mating. So therefore they were by definition evil. Well, because they were evil. I mean that's pretty well we call Jews the spawn of Satan. These giants were the spawn of these rebellious demons known as the Watchers who had sex with females here, Adamic females, and created these giants. So, yes, the giants were evil. They were evil by definition because of their parentage, and they were evil because, you read about how Goliath caused trouble here, and David called him, who is this filthy Philistine giant dog here who's causing this commotion? Someone ought to get up and kill him. And it turned out it was David who did kill Goliath. Now, Goliath, I think, was only 9 foot tall. Og and Sihon, and there is some belief here, and I've seen it. A different book than Jasher. Jasher didn't talk about hornets. But pretty well in the book of Joshua toward the end talked about hornets. Hornets going ahead and bringing forth. He's talking about on the east bank of the Jordan, the Amorites were, Og and Sihon, his brother. They were huge. They were 12 feet tall. Goliath was only 9 foot tall. Of course, I wouldn't want to face a 9 foot tall giant, much less a 12 foot tall giant. I'm only 6'2". That critter would have outweighed me by at least six times at least here. It would have been another order of magnitude. I mean So the giants were evil. They were evil because, both because of their bloodline and because they were evil. They were not. They weren't stupid. Some of them probably lived older than Methuselah. I'm not quite sure how many years it was from, the flood to the days of Yes, Moses, but they were, they lived quite some long time here. Let's see. I'm babbling right now. I'm going to have to, come on, you. Yeah, I'm sure this device could be even faster if this computer would not die on me. And make me lose my Tor browser. No, I do not want to download an update to Adobe Flash Player. Thank you very much.
Excuse me. No, no. Okay, restore. Restore my Tor browser.
Call from 813, you're live. I thank you, my friend, and 813 is Tampa area code. I'm sorry, do you have a question? I can't hear you either. I'm having the same problem with Alec. Maybe he was just listening and he muted himself. All right, well, I actually do have a question. If my question is for the gentleman that was just speaking. Now, of course, my name is Matthew. See if I'm able to log in finally. Okay.